aren't TV movies fun? Join Amanda, Dan, and Nate as they discuss their favorite made-for-TV movies on the Made-for-TV Mayhem Show.
Everybody, you're listening to the Made for TV Mayhem Show. You may have forgotten what show this was because we've been gone for such a long time. I can't even remember the last time we actually recorded, but it's been quite some time. But we're back and we're really excited to be here. The three of us are actually all here and we're all committed to this episode, which is going to be really good, I think. So just briefly, we are covering two Curtis Harrington TV movies, and I'll go really briefly into why we're doing that. But the two movies we're doing are Cat Creature from 1973 and The Killer Bees, which I believe are both ABC Movie of the Weeks. Two classic horror films from the classic era of the TV movies, and wonderful films. I'm not going to even try to hold back on my opinions on them. I think they're both really amazing and have a lot of interesting things to say, particularly The Killer Bees, so I'm really looking forward to getting to that. But before we do that, I want to say hello to my co-host. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Not much. I do want to apologize to everyone if I sound like I'm yelling at you. I'm leaning away from my mic. Skype. I just did a Skype update. That's like Dick Van Dyke, but a Skype update. But I just did a Skype update, and I hope I'm not sounding too. I'm actually leaned away from the mic, just kind of casual. You know, it's nice to be back doing Made for TV Mayhem.
Yeah, you got to lean back and enjoy it. You know,
yeah, it's been a while. Although I will say this, out of all the recordings I do podcast wise, the most stressful ones for some reason are these. I don't know why. Skype always seems to do something beforehand. Something always seems to go screwball right before. I got to ignore the Skype updates or the updikes or whatever they are they happen.
I like you to be on your toes on this podcast.
Exactly. Oh yeah. I'm good to go. I got Meryl right here, wide open, and we're ready to go. So
yay.
Excited.
And we are actually here with Nate, who I don't think I've talked to in forever. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, nothing much. Just enjoying September, I guess.
Well, have you broke out the bat pajamas yet?
No, not yet. It's not quite that weather just yet. It's still kind of warm here.
It is. Yeah, it was like 100 degrees today in Austin, and yeah, it was pretty annoying to be prepared.
We were at 82 here in the valley in Los Angeles.
That's like 100 here. Well, you guys don't, I mean, your house might, but a lot of places in LA don't have central heating, I mean, air conditioning, because you guys don't deal with the heat that much. Like, you have really temperate weather. So just
We're big on that.
Just a story I'll tell real quick, because I actually told it yesterday, and also it's going to lead us into our first segment, which is a little different, is that I went to LA out in April. I made a super secret trip, and I'll tell you why in a second. And I stayed with a good friend of mine, and you guys had a cold spell. So like, and when I say cold spell, I mean it went into like the 50s or 60s, but yes. In Texas, that's freezing. And so apparently I didn't look at the weather, and I brought one long sleeve shirt, which I had to wear all 4 days because it turned out to be kind of crisp and nice out. And so every night at around the same time, I would say, oh man, it's really cold. I didn't expect it to be this cold. And my good friend Devin turned to me and he said, did you ever think to look up the fucking weather? Because he got so tired of hearing me complain about how cold it was that he finally just like laid it out. And then he was like, can you spend the night at your other friend's house? And I was like, yes, that's actually two separate events, but he did kick me out. But only because
if I hadn't been, I was not feeling very well. I would have gladly invited you over if I had not thought that I had COVID.
Yeah. As long as you had a heater, I would have been up for it. But
we were good. Yeah,
it was a great trip. And the reason why I went out there was because I was contacted by somebody working for Shudder Television, which is a streaming platform, to be a part of their 101 Scariest Horror Movie Moments Ever, I think, or of all time is the title, full title. And I went out and I shot for like 90 minutes. They asked me some questions. I was pretty sure I didn't get anything right or say anything usable. It was a very nerve-wracking experience, even though I've done a couple of these. And it turns out I ended up on at least the first two episodes. And I'm really excited and amazed. And so Dan suggested, why don't Nate and I talk about our scariest horror movie moments ever or of all time, just to share. And I didn't really get to talk about, I think, my favorite. I didn't actually prep anything for this, but there are some movies on the list, and I don't want to give it away, that are definitely my all-time scariest. But I think there's a couple that they looked over. But they did do at least one TV movie, I can tell you. Salem's Lot is on the
Yay.
list. I can say that because they've already aired that episode. So they have some good stuff. I have seen the full list. It's pretty amazing. I think people are pretty happy with the show so far. So if you don't have Shudder, or if you do have Shudder and you want to check it out, that's where to go. They're releasing one episode a week. By the time this comes out, they'll probably have done three or four episodes. But I think you can backtrack and watch them whenever you want if you have the subscription. But anyway, enough of that. Let's go ahead and have you guys share a couple of your favorite horror movie moments. I know this was your idea, Dan. That's why I'm going to hand it over to Nate first, just to stick it in your
Sure. Do you want to do
Oh.
Nate does three, and then I'll do Nate does his first. I'll do my first, and we'll back and
Yeah,
forth.
I think you guys
Okay.
will just go back and forth,
Sounds good.
and then we'll see what we'd like to say about them, each other's
Yeah.
or your guys' choices. So,
Yeah.
Nate, what would you say is one of your all-time scariest horror movie moments?
And this is in no particular order.
Okay.
But yeah, so the first one I wanted to bring up is definitely from my childhood. So it's still the kind of the fear that I had when I was a kid still kind of resonates with me today. And it's from Tourist Trap. And it's the scene where the character Eileen leaves the Oasis store and goes down to the house. And she's climbing in through a window, and there's all these like mannequins, and it's dark and it's creepy. And then you start hearing somebody whispering her name, like, and then when you see what it is, it's like this mannequin-faced figure, and that terrified me as a kid. So that's one I'm gonna go with because it's still kind of, I find it pretty freaky today too.
Is that the girl that's in the rocking chair and she's got like the scarf and the knitted shawl on?
Yes, later, she's like there, yeah.
Okay. So the first time, I don't know exactly when it happens, but the first time I saw Tourist Trap, I was an adult and a really good friend of mine was introducing me to a lot of horror. Actually, him and his roommate, we were just renting them like crazy. And he's like, "You have to see Tourist Trap." And he rented it, and there's a scene, I think, in that house with Eileen. I think that's where it happens, where one of the mannequins comes forward and it's like, oh, for the first time, or one of those.
Yes.
And
Yes.
I actually screamed out loud. I could not contain how freaked out I was. And ever since then, I've loved that movie. So the Eileen, I didn't know the character's name. That's why I wanted to clarify who she was in the film. The whole thing when she goes down to the house, like, oh, the buildup of all of that scene is tremendous. That is such a good choice. And Dan, what do you th you must remember this scene too, I'm guessing.
I do. I actually about a month or two before COVID hit, the Egyptian Theater did maybe it was 3 or 4 months before, they did an all day horror thing, and the last film they showed was Tourist Trap, so I got to see it on the big screen, and it was so good. And yeah, the first time I saw it, yeah, it was on video before then. I loved it, and my wife was actually, she was in like an acting class or something, and they had guests who would show up from the entertainment industry, and the director of Tourist, this was 20 years ago, the director
Oh,
of Tourist Trap
David
was
Schmoller or
there.
something like that,
Yes,
right?
yes. And she was like, and I said, who was the guest today? Oh, David Schmoller or something. He's a director. And I said, Tourist Trap. And she looked at me and said, what are you talking about? And I said, he made Tourist Trap. Yeah, he did. He told us that with Tanya Roberts. I go, yeah, it's fantastic. Scare the hell out of you. Chuck Connors at his nuttiest. You thought he was great as the Rifleman. You should see him as this giant mannequin guy thing, whatever he
It's
is.
a party. You remember that part?
Yes.
Tanya Roberts, by the way, is great in that film. And I remember David Schmoller talking on the commentary, which is pretty good, about it was an early role for her and how she really came in and she was working really hard, and one of her earliest roles. And she really had this
Yes.
desire to act. And she's quite good in it and she's stunning.
Yeah, oh, she's great. Is that before Charlie's Angels?
Yeah, a little before Charlie's
okay,
Angels. I think
she did. I think Forced Entry. I think she did before that. Yeah,
which I
that
haven't was, seen.
I haven't seen it in 20 years.
Yeah,
a long time. Yeah,
but yeah, everything about that movie is so good. That's
it's
a
fun.
great
So weird.
choice.
So weird. Yeah.
Dan, what would you pick?
My number three is I don't quite know how to describe the scene, but it's from a film called Hell House LLC. It's a more recent film, and it's about a bunch of filmmakers who go in. They're basically taking an old haunted hotel, and they're going to make it into the Halloween attraction, and things go crazy in the house. And the film, there are three, it's a trilogy, and it has this one of the scariest basements in all of horror film history. But there's a scene in it where sort of the snarky, I think, cameraman is, they all stay in the hotel, and he's in his dingy hotel room about to go to bed, and he's testing his camera. And as he's moving the camera around the room, it passes the doorway, and something's standing in the doorway.
Ooh.
And it's a found footage sort of documentary type kind of thing, you know, that we all know and love. And and it's one of those scenes where he kind of throws the sheet over himself. And then he keeps lifting up the sheet, and the whatever it is a little closer.
Ugh.
A little closer. Ooh. And by the end of the scene, and I watched this like 6 months ago, I had my hand I'm an old guy. I had my hand over my face peeking out through my fingers. And it gets closer and closer and closer. And the ending is very much like that short film, I want to say Lights Out.
Oh, movie is so scary.
Yes, where the woman keeps
scary.
Yeah, where the woman keeps turning and this thing gets close, and then she's at her bedside, and you see the and that's this is a variation of that, and it's a scary film. There are some crazy clowns in the basement that will make you shriek. Like I said, the whole trilogy is great, but this is a scene. This is the one scene. Well, I like quite a few of the scenes, but this was the one that, like, when the movie was over, I was like, Dan, did you just literally put your hands over your face and almost throw a blanket over your head during this scene? So yeah, and this scene, I've watched it again since then, did the same thing. So that's my third. It's a more recent one for me, but it's one that I know will sit with me for a
God,
while.
Sounds great. Nate, have you seen it?
Oh yes, I love that movie. It is really scary.
The basement is the best because it has this old rotten like staircase, but then you have to immediately turn to the right. And because it's found footage, the camera goes down, and then turns to the right. You never know what's standing right there.
Ugh.
And it's like the clowns are crazy, and the layout of the hotel, it's deliberately, it's not like an H.H. Holmes kind of thing specifically, but it's laid out like kind of crazy. So as many times as they go through the hotel, you're never quite certain where you are, but you see certain things. You go, oh, we're in the kitchen. Oh, we're at this room. Oh, we're in the attic. You know, stuff like that. But it's a beautiful trilogy. The folks who made it did a real nice job. And there's
give us the title again, just so everybody can check it out.
Oh, Hell House LLC.
Perfect.
And they have the two and three have like subtitles, but you look up Hell House, LLC,
okay.
And it's great.
That sounds really good. And that made me think of when we're talking about newer movies, and I'll just be very brief. Off the top of my head, one of my favorite, most recent scary scenes was in the first Paranormal Activity. When you talk about watching movies where you've got your hands over your eyes,
yes.
Like for some reason, ghost stories, even though I don't necessarily believe in ghosts one way or the other, but like there's a scene when I don't even remember the whole thing. It's been a while since I've seen it, but they're sleeping in bed, and I think the woman gets up and mm-hmm. stands over the guy sleeping.
Yes.
And she just stares at him, and there's like the little time rolling at the bottom.
Yes.
And it's just all night.
Yes.
And I'm like, what is happening? And like, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
it freaked
exactly.
me out to the point that I've never seen another Paranormal Activity because I got so scared watching it that I just couldn't bear the idea of watching any of the sequels. And I know I want to see, I loved it, but it just, there's something about it that really got to me. I thought that was a good one. And Nate, you've seen all the Paranormal Activities, right?
Yes, I've seen them all.
Do you like them?
I like them all, yeah. I don't know, I just, I know that there are people that don't care for the sequels, but, you know, they're varying in quality, but overall, I enjoy them all.
Awesome. I had never seen one until right before Thanksgiving of last year, 2021, and Amazon had a set of the first six for like 15, six? 15, there are seven.
Oh my God.
If you count, is it the dark, what's the one, Nate, where they go to the farm and I forget what it's, and they think it's an Amish family, but they're actually not. It's the Dark Ones or something. Ooh, like that.
Oh yeah. The titles, I can't.
Yes, I know. I don't remember because what happened was the week before Thanksgiving, I picked up the first six, and for some reason, over the next six Fridays from like Thanksgiving to Christmas, I watched one a Friday. I would finish work, get dinner, sit down and watch it. So I watched all six Paranormal Act, the first six, over the course of 6 weeks. And they're so much fun if you watch them like that, because they're all interconnected.
Yes.
And they all go back. And it's just like, there's a moment in like three or four where suddenly like a character is suddenly back in the house from one, and you're like, and you're at the end of part one, and you're like, what the hell is going on? It's, they really thought it through, I think. And that's awesome. And it's filled with like scares where you just want to pee your pants and run.
Yeah. I love it. It just really got to me for some reason. It's a very effective film. Nate, what's your next pick?
My next pick, I'm definitely going to go a little more obvious with this one, because it's another one that stuck with me from childhood, but it's the classic eye through the door scene in Black Christmas.
Yeah, iconic.
Yeah,
iconic.
It's and for anyone that doesn't know, and I'm going to try to not be too spoilery here, but you know, Black Christmas is about a killer that sneaks into the attic of the sorority house over the Christmas holidays and begins to kill the girls in the house. And after each kill, he calls and talks to the main character on the phone, and the phone calls themselves are very creepy and scary as well. But like, you know, for most of the movie, obviously they don't know that the killer is in the house. And towards the end of the film, you know, when Olivia Hussey finally finds out that they are, that the killer actually is in the house, you know, she, being a good friend, probably better friend than I would be, she goes upstairs to check on them, and she's like pushing on this bedroom door, but it's like won't budge for a minute, and then finally it gives way and she falls down as it does, and you know, she sees, you know, the craziness that's going on in that room. I won't spoil it, but then she hears the same whispering that she hears in those phone calls, and then she looks over, and the crack in the door, there's an eye just staring at her. Basically, the killer's on the other side of the door. And then, you know, of course, she takes off, and the killer takes off after her in very hot pursuit.
Screaming. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, it's a great scene. The build-up to it's very quiet, but once the action starts, like, her and the killer are both screaming. It's a pretty scary sequence.
Yeah, in a really scary film. I mean, like, yes. You're talking about that scene, and I'm running the movie through my head, and I'm like, oh, wait, that scene was scary?
Yes.
That scene was scary? That scene was scary?
Yes.
I think the first phone call always kind of gets me, because I think they use three people to record the call, and I think it's Nick Mancuso, there was a woman, and maybe Bob Clark with the three voices, I think. And they all blend together, and it's supposed to be one person, and it's just so jarring the first time you hear it, plus the language and everything. It just really like just sets you like, oh, I'm so uncomfortable right now. That's such a great scene though. That eyeball is like, and to keep it in the realm of TV movies, it's very Bad Ronald-y, which came out I think the same year. So
I thought of both of those.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And I know, Dan, you must have some things to say about Black Christmas.
Oh, I adore Black Christmas. I've watched it once a year, every year since 1994. And I've owned it on crappy VHS, crappier VHS, crappy DVD, better DVD, decent Blu-ray, and I think I've got a good Blu-ray now. But yeah, it's such a great movie. I mean, my sort of favorite moments, that's one of my favorites, The Scream. And but just the I love those scenes with, well, I don't love them, that's not the right word, where they're looking for the little girl who's gone missing.
Yeah.
And they're in the park or the woods, and you see all these people out there just looking for, trying to find this little girl, and you could tell it's so cold and everyone's so freezing. And then when they find the little girl, and the mom pushes forward through everyone, looks down, and you don't see the little girl, but the mom lets out this scream.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's not scary, but it's heartbreak. And that's one of the great things about the movies. You get moments like the fellatio scene, which is hilarious. And you just get the image of, you know, the one gal there, the leading gal from Strange Brew with the plastic bag over her head, just in the rocking chair with the cat licking her face. You get Mrs. What's-Her-Name with the booze everywhere. Yeah.
And, Mrs. Mack,
yes, who was so great and deranged. Yes. Around the same time, and you get everything, and you get one of those, and of course the ending of that movie when the camera slowly moves away, and then the phone rings.
Don't spoil it. So good. Yeah.
And the phone rings, and it's Ed McMahon. They won some sort of prize. I don't know. Sorry, everyone. Don't listen to that. We're not going to put a spoiler alert. No. Sorry, everyone.
But yeah, everything in that movie is so well done. It's like a perfect film for me. And Nate and I were actually talking before the recording about how I saw somebody online saying something about a horror movie. And they said, well, it has a lot of unlikable characters, but that's par for the course. And we were like, that's not necessarily the norm. And Black Christmas is a perfect example of a movie filled with characters that you love and you care about and you want to see make it to the end. And when some of them don't, it's really upsetting, you know, because you're invested in them, particularly one character. And I won't say who it is, but and you guys are probably thinking a couple of different people maybe. But anyway, it's so good. Dan, what is your next pick?
My next pick, we're going to go to Australia, and we are going to go to the I didn't look it up. I've seen the film three times, but I didn't look up to see exactly where this footage is from. But it's the last moments, I think, of a young girl who drowns in a lake. It's the last moments of her cell phone footage. She's at a party with some friends, and she leaves the party. Something weird is going on at the party. And as she's walking away from the party with her, it's her cell phone in front of her, something out of the darkness begins to walk towards her.
Yeah, don't be too spoilery. Now, is this like Mungo?
Like Mungo. That's all I'm saying.
I haven't seen it. So
no, I apologize, but it's the final moments of the cell phone footage in Lake Mungo, and that's it.
Yeah, I know that exists, but I've hold off on it. I really want to see it, and for some reason, when it comes down to picking movies, I always forget that I should watch that. And
one I do, I'll say the title first.
Okay, that's fine.
I thought I'd be dramatic.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, that's
good. Nate, I know you've seen this movie. You're a big fan of it, aren't you?
Oh, I love Lake Mungo. It's actually, I think it's a very sad and haunting horror film. Like, there's just a lot of, talk about, dealing with the trauma of this girl's death and, how it's affected the family and things like that. I mean, it's got a lot of heart. But Dan is right. When they do recover the cell phone footage, I was like, I wasn't ready for that. Yes. I'll just say that. So very good. Very good. Very good choice.
Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. So Lake Mungo, everybody, I think that everybody kind of knows how it ends. They just don't know exactly what everybody sees at the film. That's my understanding anyway. So we haven't spoiled it, which is great. I can't think of another one off the top of my head. I mean, I mentioned Bad Ronald, which would be like one of the most iconic moments ever, the eyeball scene in that. So I'll just say, if I'm going to pick one randomly, I'll pick that one. Nate, what's your next pick?
My next one is from Candyman from 1992. Tony Todd is honestly brilliant as Candyman. He is fantastic. But the parts of Candyman that I find terrifying is actually the beginning, where we just hear the lore about Candyman. And in particular, the scene where, they're learning the story of this character called Ruthie Jean, who called the police because Candyman or someone was trying to break through the walls, and the police didn't believe her. And by the time they finally got to her house, she was dead. Well, there's a scene where they run into a neighbor of hers named Anne Marie, and they're just kind of talking to her. And then Anne Marie just kind of talks about what the night was like when Ruthie Jean was killed, how she could hear her screaming through the walls, and how, she's scared for her child and for herself, because she's like, they're never going to catch him. And, of course, they're like, who? And she's like, the Candyman. And I just think that's terrifying, to think that there was this, you know, person like behind the walls. Like, and this idea that he could just come into your apartment anytime he felt like it. I think that movie is very good. And, you know, the beginning, especially, I find very scary, especially that film score. It's got an amazing score.
It has an amazing score. It's been a long time since I've seen the original Candyman, but what I remember most about it is kind of the urban decay and that kind of like sense of dread. And when they first show up at Cabrini Green and they've got all that graffiti, including that like mouth that opens, right? Mm-hmm. It's just so beautifully done. And it reminds me that even though Clive Barker didn't make Candyman, like he wrote the story it's based on, but that movie and Hellraiser both have these really great kind of urban decay aesthetics that I really love, and that I think create a lot of dread in the film. And so what I remember most about it is a feeling of dread more than just, and her and poor Virginia Madsen getting arrested.
I remember
that. Yeah.
Her character gets a raw deal.
She sure does.
It's funny. Like, you think Ash got it rough in Evil Dead. Well, I don't know.
No, she got it worse. Yeah. What do you remember about the movie, Dan?
I remember really enjoying it. I saw it in a sold out theater the night it came out, and I saw it with three or four friends, and we shrieked and we just had a great time. But I do also remember there were two people behind us who kept doing that thing where it was like, "What's he doing there? He's going to see that guy. What's she doing? She's talking to the mirror. Why? It's a candy man." It's like, and at least at two occasions, we turned around and said, "Please stop. Please stop." I think that may have been one of the last. No, I think the next year it was Jason Goes to Hell. That was one of the last horror films I've seen in the theater apart from old horror films.
Yeah.
Because I have a tough time seeing new horror films in the theater because I can't deal with the way people deal with movies sometimes. But I don't mind older stuff. But it's like, I like, when I saw Jason Goes to Hell, it was literally 90 minutes of people screaming and going, get him, do it, guy, you got it. And it's just like, I can't do it. I need
to. I loved, I went, Jason Goes to Hell was my first Friday the 13th in the theater. And I had a really good time with it. My friend hated it because, like a lot of people complain, it's not really Jason. He's sort of like doing the hidden and body hopping. And I was so excited to be there. And my friend sat there with his arms crossed the whole time. But everybody in the theater was like, "Oh my God." And it was actually, I thought it was really fun. But like for something like Candyman or Hellraiser, I just saw Hellraiser, not the night it came out, but I think that Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And my friend and I were the only two women in the theater. We were 17.
Oh, wow.
And it was all men, and it was very quiet, and I'd never seen anything like Hellraiser before. Like, it blew my mind, and I never forgot it. But like, so I had a really good audience for that. But movies like that, like Candyman, you want a really good audience that keeps quiet because it's so scary, and you have somebody whispering behind you. It kind of takes away all of the tension. And you're getting irked. And so what's the point?
It's a little rough.
But I go see movies when I can. Like, I go see Insidious when it comes out and all those kind of films. And I don't know. They're fun. But I think older movies, they're supposed to be like more of a crowd sort of thing happening. Mm-hmm. Unless they're mocking the film, which case I get really mad.
I'm not thrilled.
But as long as they're enjoying. Actually, I went to a screening, I guess, before the pandemic of Lost Boys.
Oh.
And there was a girl sitting next to me. She was probably like 20. And her boyfriend or date was talking to her, and she'd never seen the film before. And she literally sat there so excited, and he was actually like, hands were in the air, and she was like laughing at all the right parts, and she would put her hands over her mouth, and it was like, and she really enjoyed it, and it was so much fun. It was at the Alamo, so nobody spoke, but it was, have to say, it was really fun sitting next to this really young person watching this 80s horror film and just getting really into it. It was so exciting for me because that's one of my all time favorite films. So, anyway, Dan, what is your final scary? And then I remembered one, so I have one.
Okay, and I have two very quick honorable mentions. That just you don't have to talk about them. But the first one is actually I'm going to do three. They're all from Final Exam. I'm kidding. No, my first one is from the original version of The Eye.
I don't know that I've seen it. It sounds like I should have, but I don't know if I have.
The Eye is possibly my favorite horror film. Just because whenever anyone asks me, what's a good one that's scary and imaginative, I always say The Eye. Not the, I haven't seen the remake, the original one, the I forget the brothers, it was two brothers who made it. But it has about half a dozen super scary scenes in it. But I'm just going to say, for those of you who've seen it, the calligraphy scene. And you have to watch it. Don't watch it on your phone. Don't watch it with shitty sound. Put it on a nice side screen, get stereo sound or surround sound going, because part of the scare is the sound in it. But it's basically our leading lady, who's a character who's just got new corneas and is seeing for the first time, I forget if it's ever or in years, goes to a calligraphy class and something goes wrong. And I've only seen the film maybe five times. It's not out on Blu-ray, for heaven's sake, maybe both. But whenever that scene comes up, it's about 40, 45 minutes into the film, I always sit there going, okay, Dan, you're about to scream. Here we go. I'd always turn up the volume as loud as I can. And my wife's like, turn it down. And I said, just give me a minute. And then I go, ah! And she goes, are you okay? And I'm okay. I'm okay. But it's the calligraphy scene from the eye is the scene that always, like the other two always scare me too, but this is one that has scared me longer than the other two have.
So what year is this film?
Oh my gosh.
Like, you give me a ballpark.
2005?
Okay, I know a movie.
It's in the 2000s. It's in the 2000s. It's about, yeah, she gets a cornea and it's sort of like a, she can see dead people sort of thing, but it's more interesting than that. Cool. It's a Hong Kong film, so it's like Hong Kong action films. You know, if you like, someone describes a Hong Kong action film to you, and then you go see it, you're like, okay, this is 100 times better than their explanation. So I'm not going to explain more, but it's the Ping brothers made it.
Yes, I am familiar with the movie. I have not seen it, and I know the calligraphy scene. Like, I haven't seen it, but I've heard people talk about it.
I adore it.
It's pretty famous, yeah. Nate, have you seen The Eye?
I have not. I've actually only seen the remake.
Oh, how was the remake?
I like the remake a lot. Yeah. But I don't have the original to compare it to, so I'm about to watch the original.
It's beautifully done. It's one of those. It structurally, I love the structure of the movie. And it's just, I think that's one of the things, is not only is it scary, not only does it have these great scenes, but it's emotionally resonant and it has an interesting structure to it. And the final sequence is great. So the eye. Perfect. Calligraphy scene.
Okay, so before you do your honorable mentions, let me just do mine real quick. So So I was lucky enough to catch Jaws in 3D recently. Because they re-released it and they did this beautiful job making it three-dimensional. And some of it was like watching the film for the first time. And so there are two scenes in particular. Well, there's three scenes, but the Kittner death, you know, Alex Kittner's death, the little boy on the raft. I'd never seen it like that before, and I'm never going to forget it. It was so terrifying. But the scene that I'm thinking of is when Hooper is swimming underneath Ben Gardner's boat. And there's that hole in the boat and there's a shark tooth and he goes to loosen the tooth.
Oh, yeah.
And then the Ben Gardner's head comes missing the eye kind of through the hole in the boat, not through it. You can see the head on the other side. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the theater jumped. And I guarantee you, we'd all knew that scene was coming, but it freaked me out. And I don't know. We've never talked about Jaws, but Nate, are you a big fan of the film?
Oh, I love Jaws. I think it's amazing. Like, I know some people think it kind of slows down in some scenes, but to me, it never does. Like, I love when they're all on the boat, even when they're just sitting around listening to, like, you know, each other's stories.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's such a brilliant film. I don't necessarily find it super terrifying, but that's only because, though, I'm not very familiar with the ocean. I don't live near it. So I don't think I would find myself out in the ocean, and hopefully Jaws would look at me and be like, ugh, no, not worth it.
Not worth I don't time. Think he would. He just ate. He ate He's whatever hungry. Was He's... around. He never felt full. And like in 3D, Quint's death was like ridiculous. Like in some portions, it was like seeing the movie for the first time. And I've seen this movie 100 times, and I've seen it several times in the theater because it comes out all the time in re-releases. But nothing has ever captured me the way it does in 3D. And it's interesting. I think the word I've seen used that is the best way to describe it is that it's absolutely immersive. And Dan, are you a big fan of Jaws?
I am. I quite enjoy all four of them.
Yeah, I do too.
The first one is one that I think is absolutely a absolute beautiful piece of cinema. But then you know me, I'm a jerk. I begin to look at the others.
Oh, Jaws 2 is like a slasher. It's perfect.
Yeah, and we did the Jay Shark episode earlier this year, didn't we? Yeah. I think. And Jaws 3D has its charms. And Jaws the Revenge, if you can put aside the silliness of the basic plot, it ain't a bad shark attack
movie. It's a good movie. It was really great to see a middle-aged woman as the final girl.
Yes.
And it actually deals with loss and grief. Like, it actually has a lot of merit to it. And it was directed by a predominantly TV movie director, Joseph Sargent.
Yeah, Joseph Sargent, yeah.
Yeah, and that's probably why 3 is just a lot of fun. And 2, Jaws is a perfect film, but Jaws 2 is like my Halloween 2. It's the one I watch the most because it's got the most shark attacks and it's got the teens on the wall. Yes, I mean, it's just so much fun, but that would be mine. And so let's just go through your honorable mentions real quick, and then
I'm
we'll dive in.
Real quick. The first one is this is another Bob Clark film, Murder by Decree.
Oh, you know, I've never seen that.
And so I won't say much about it, but it is. I think it's when Mary Kelly is being tortured and killed. I'm not going to tell you much about the scene, but. You're basically sitting outside like a shop window in a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heart of London in the middle of the night in the fog, and you can hear sounds, you can hear like mechanical sounds, you can hear screaming, but the window you're looking at is a glass block, so you can only see shapes, so you can't see, so the camera slowly pulls in as you hear this noise and you can't see what's happening, and it's because there is a photo, there is a crime scene photo you can see online of Mary Kelly's crime scene. You don't want to look it up. Please don't look it up. But I happened to, just because I was in, after reading From Hell, the Alan Moore Jack the Ripper, I got Jack the Ripper Jag, and I saw it, and I was like, okay, I'm stopping. But there's a scene, and you'll know it when you see it. The camera slowly tracks in on a shop front where you can't see through the glass, and someone is being tortured on the other side of the glass. And it's harrowing. One of the things that always scares me is when you distort the human shape. Mm-hmm. The human I mean, like, one of the scariest trailers when I was a kid was Fright Night, when Amanda Beers, who I love and Married with Children, when she turns and looks at the main guy and her mouth is like 3 times the size it should be.
Yes, that's about, yeah, famous.
That's
scene,
yeah. And it's scared that it's the distort. It's like Grave Encounters 1 and 2 does that, where the faces, the shapes, they get like all out of whack. And that actually ties in with my other honorable mention, which is the moment when the poor, hapless but determined reporter from REC, REC, sees the inhabitant of the top floor apartment at the end of REC.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen that either.
That's a good choice.
Yeah. that's the moment she sees, you're like, okay, I'm done. I'm leaving. And so that's, I was going to make that my number 3, but Hell House I saw more recent. But that's one of those two where when you see the body, the person who's moving, the shape is all wrong. The body is all out of place and stuff. And it's like, ooh, but those are my two honorable mentions. Both of them could have been in the top 3, but I flipped a coin this morning and they were number 4 and 5.
Well, that was a great list, guys. You both picked really cool films and movies I'm going to seek out. That Hell House movie sounds amazing. And so
all 3 of them are great. A week. Do 1 a week.
I'm literally looking forward to it because I don't watch enough newer stuff. So that was great. And I hope everybody enjoyed that. I know that wasn't TV movie talk, so we're going to dive in to Curtis Harrington. So I said briefly I would tell you how we came here. So a few months ago, Dan, Nate, and I were able to get together and do a commentary track for Tarantula's The Deadly Cargo, which is this great 70s monster attack movie. And when I was assigning other TV movie monster or bug attack, I guess, movies, I guess I gave you guys a different B-movie than the Killer Bee movie I watched. And so you guys ended up watching Terror Out of the Sky or something, and I watched Killer Bees, and I was so enamored with it. And I'd seen The Cat Creature, which I remembered enjoying, and I'd been wanting to rewatch it. So I thought, oh, next time we get together, we should do a Curtis Harrington episode. So that's how we ended up here. And so I'm really excited. And before we dive in, I will say I haven't devised the contest yet, but I have an extra copy of Tarantulas on Blu-ray, and I think we'll probably be doing a contest in the near future for that. And I might have a t-shirt contest too. I don't know yet. But so I've got some stuff I'd like to give away. I also have another Blu-ray I might give away too. So please stay tuned for that in our future episodes when I figure out how I want to configure all of that. But let me tell you a little bit about Curtis Harrington, and then we'll dive into our first film. So Harrington was born in L.A. He lived, though, in a more rural part of California called Beaumont. He began making films as a teenager, and then he started making experimental shorts. But his career was really wild. He did some experimental filmmaking, but he also did theatrical studio system movies. He did TV. He did a lot in episodics, but he did do a couple of TV movies. He actually began his career in Paris. So he went to Paris to get a film studies degree, or I'm sorry, he got his film studies degree from UCLA. Then he moved to France and he wrote a book on Joseph von Sternberg. And while he was there, he ended up falling into a really interesting community of filmmakers who included Kenneth Anger, James Whale, and Bill Condon. And then eventually he would end up working for Roger Corman. But I think when people think of Curtis Harrington, if you have any knowledge of his films, there's a couple of movies you may think of, but I think one of the first that may come to mind is a movie he made called Night Tide, which was his first feature-length film from 1961, starring Dennis Hopper as a man who may or may not be in love with a mermaid who kills people. It's a beautiful film. It's very low budget. It's very evocative. It's kind of nightmarish and dreamy, and it's really moving. I really liked it. I think it has some Harrington-ness we might see in his other films, particularly I might talk about it if I remember when we get to Cat Creature, this idea of gay subtext, and I might go into that. But he also did a bunch of other movies. He did something called Queen of Blood in 1966. He did a movie called Games, which I just saw a few months ago.
Yes, I like Games.
Is it Simone Signoret? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right.
I believe so, yeah. I think that's right.
Catherine, oh my God, I can't remember her name now. She starred in The Stepford Wives. And
Ross, Catherine Ross.
Catherine Ross and James Caan. And it's kind of like, I don't know how to explain the movie, but visually it's amazing.
It reminds me of some Ingmar Bergman type films like The Magician or Persona, where it's like playing with their games and reality and things like that.
It's a little bit of gaslighting in there too. And
yes, true.
Yeah, it's a gaslighting film. And he did What's the Matter with Helen, which I know I haven't seen, but I did see Whoever Slew Auntie Rue. And then he would go on to make The Killing Kind and Ruby throughout the 70s. Yay. And as I mentioned, he was friends with James Whale. And in the 90s, David DeVell kind of, he interviewed Curtis Harrington about James Whale, but he wrote this about both of them, and I thought this might encapsulate his career best. So DeVell wrote, quote, "James Whale and Curtis Harrington were fortunate to have the horror genre to channel their unique self-expression. The finest of James Whale's work is unquestionably The Old Dark House and Bride of Frankenstein, while Harrington crystallized his talents with his first feature, Night Tide, and then matured with what is arguably his best feature, What's the Matter with Helen? Like Whale, Harrington's feature work has withstood the test of time. When a filmmaker is as intensely personal as a Wells or a von Sternberg, the dangers of working in Hollywood are obvious. For unlike Whale's time, the Hollywood of 1996 is littered with bloated budgets, rehashed sequels, and the worship of youthful directors with enormous clout," end quote. So apparently, Curtis Harrington was a little obsessed with Edgar Allan Poe. He had some fascination with them. So his last film was a short titled Usher, which is an imaginative adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's Follow the House of Usher. And I'm bringing this up because the first horror film he ever saw was The Raven with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. And his mother told people that Harrington was so scared that he hid under his seat. But he ended up loving the genre, and in an interview with Filmmaker Magazine, he said, quote, "I have a very macabre turn of mind, and there's no way that can be explained. It's just a leaning I've had since childhood, and I have it to this day," end quote. So, of course, Curtis sadly died in 2007. What he left behind in terms of TV films is pretty interesting. His first movie was How Awful About Alan in 1970 with Anthony Perkins. Then he did The Cat Creature, Killer Bees. He did a movie I haven't seen yet called The Dead Don't Die. I wanted to see that before recorded.
Oh, yes.
And of course,
that came out on VHS, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It does have a home video release.
Anton Differing or someone's in that.
He did Devil Dog the Hound from Hell, which is probably his most famous TV movie. But for this podcast, we are going to concentrate on two movies he did back-to-back, and that is The Cat Creature and The Killer Bees. And we're going to start with The Cat Creature, which came out first on December 11th, 1973 on ABC.
I'm just gonna read the Merrill description, just because we did all the horror chat, so I want to dive right in.
Okay.
Folks, you should have watched this. This is in this chiller of Valentine of the fondly remembered horror B movie, the theft of an amulet from the mummy of an Egyptian sets off a reign of terror that involves an archaeology professor, a mysterious shopkeeper, a pretty sales girl, and an oriental thief. So that's all.
Okay, so I had seen The Cat Creature once before, probably about 8 or 9 years ago. I remembered really liking it. I really liked it on this viewing. I think it's got a lot of merit. It's got some great actors. It's got a lot of ambiance, and it's got a really neat kind of gay subtext with some of the characters. So it's kind of a layered film, and I was really surprised by a little bit of the content that made it onto TV in 1973. And we'll probably talk about that. Dan, had you seen this before?
Yes, I did. When I first met you back in 1893, when did we first meet? 2014? I think it was 2014. And you asked me to review some movies for your book. I really got into TV movies. That's when I got into TV movies like crazy. And I was specifically watching ones that were 73 or 74 minutes. Because I love that. I've said that many times. My favorite length for a movie is around 72, 73 minutes. And Cat Creature was one of the first ones I watched. And I remember watching it and having such a great time. But I hadn't watched it again since I watched it like a week ago or so. And it's still a lot of fun. It is very much... having seen many more 1930s, 1940s B movies and things, it's very much in that
Bane
realm. Yeah. And I think it's a lot of fun to watch. I'll say more about it later, but I think it's nicely paced. It's nicely put together. The ending does have one of those things where throughout the history of cinema, or TV, I was actually going to mention, there's an X-Files episode called Teso dos Biches or something like that from season 3, where there are killer cats, and it has the exact same problem at the end of this movie does, where, you know, you can't train cats like dogs. And so a lot of times when cats attack people, it's like the octopus attacking Bela Lugosi in Bride of the Monster.
Yeah.
It's someone holding up a cat going, oh, my God, oh, my God. And the cat is like, what the hell?
It's
what
purring.
The hell?
Yeah.
It's like, so the ending is, I would call the ending, although this may be disingenuous, I would call the ending camp. But I'm not 100% sure of that, but the moment where Meredith we're not going to spoil it, but I would call it's wonderfully sharp throughout, and I like the ending too. But at the very ending, I think they teeter over into camp, but that ain't bad. I didn't suddenly go ah, but I like it, and there's a lot of great actors, and it's great to see. I've never said his name out loud. Is it Key Luke?
I always say Key Luke, but you're right. I've never tried to pronounce his name.
Key Luke. The great thing about Key Luke is that he was, as far as I know, back in the late 30s, the first Asian actor to play a lead Asian detective. during the time of Mr. Wong and Charlie Chan. He played Mr. Wong Detective in the last of that series. He was the lead actor. And it's so refreshing after seeing, you know, the Charlie Chans and the, you know, Boris Karloffs, yeah, and the
there was
Peter
definitely
Lawrence.
An idea that Curtis Harrington knew that world really well because
yes.
of the way he cast the film
it's
with David
really
Carradine.
Sharp, yeah.
And there's another actor whose name I'm totally forgetting now that opens the film in the house. That
oh,
was
oh,
known
yes, yes.
for those
I can
films.
Look him up.
And yeah. and so like he
Kent
had his,
Smith.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing, you know, and yes. And we can talk a little bit about the people who made the film when we get there, but I just want to catch Nate's opinion. What do you think of the cat creature?
This was a first-time viewing for me, which I seem to rarely say on this show.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I'm just kidding. I feel like almost every movie we watch
oh,
is a first-time viewing for me. Yeah. But, I mean, that's a good thing. I like to be introduced to new things. But this one, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I loved the character of Hester, although I thought that there was something shady going on with her
yeah.
the whole time. You know, I was just like,
yes.
I don't know. I'm like, is she behind what's going on? I don't know. But so I was very suspicious of her throughout the film. And I think what really got me was in the beginning, because she's so nice to this, you know, sales clerk that works with her. But the sales clerk is so like off putting towards her.
Yeah.
She's just like, oh, you know, she's a super nice. Like she gives her stuff like and she's just like, oh, God, I can't stand her. Is that what she acts like when she gets home? But anyway,
yes.
yeah, so I was like a little, like, what's going on there? She seems nice to me.
Well,
so I was like, well, maybe she's shady.
She's extra nice to the women in this
yeah.
film. And
yes.
there's probably a reason for that because it's alluded
yes.
to that she's gay. And there's this great scene in the movie. Well, first of all, I watched Night Tide this weekend. And there's a, I don't know if, have you seen the movie, Nate?
I've not seen Night Tide, no.
I think you'd really like it, but there's this character in the film that's this woman who wears all black, and she's lanky and tall, just like Hester. And she follows the potential mermaid, Mora, around the beach. And I thought it was interesting that Harrington kind of recreated that look and stuff. But in Night Tide, what stood out to me was the idea that there's a character in it, the one that's sort of the father figure to the girl that might be the mermaid, and he's talking about going to the bathhouse to get a pounding, but he means massage.
Oh.
And but he's clearly, there's two meanings to that. And there's a scene in The Cat Creature, which I don't know if you guys remember, but there's two people talking to Hester. I think they're talking to Hester at the counter, and one of them smoking.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and
yeah.
and one is clearly a woman, and the other one looks like a man smoking. And they both
yes.
turn around, and they're both women. And one's just
yes,
really
I
masculine.
Remember that scene.
And I was really
yeah.
surprised by like the content of this film. And so Gail Sondergaard, I think, is the name of the actress who plays Hester.
She is, yes.
Yeah, she yeah. She's being extra nice to the young women who work for her for a number of reasons. And
yeah.
you know what I mean? And I like that aspect of it. You know, I thought it was really interesting to see something like that on TV in 1973.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious to see what people picked up on it as well as we did all these years later when there's so much of that on TV now that it's a little easier to spot. But yeah, so Hester was a really interesting character to me. But I didn't mean to cut you off. Was there other things you wanted to talk about, Nate?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I loved, you know, Meredith Baxter's character. Usually I'm not a big fan of the police investigation angle in a movie, but this one, I think because it's such a short film.
Yeah.
You know, it's only like, you know, it's less than 80 minutes long. And so, I mean, it didn't feel drawn out or it didn't really drag or anything for me. And personally, I have to say that I won't give away the ending, but I will say the villain's look at the end, I really liked.
That's good.
I thought it was cool.
That's real cool. I agree. I absolutely agree. Yeah, this was a really neat movie. I think Dan knows more about the movies from the 30s and 40s that this movie's kind of emulating and maybe even parodying at the end than I do. But yeah, I liked that Harrington, now knowing that he knew James Whale, I mean, it all kind of makes sense, like where he was in this place in Hollywood and sort of paying tribute to these films that he loved so much, knowing too that he saw The Raven and it terrified him when he was a kid. And so there's just a lot happening in this movie that's really fun. And I agree with you. It's 80 it's 73 minutes, right? Or 74 minutes.
So it's just 73, 74, yeah.
Yeah, it just moves by at a clip. And yet it crams in a lot of stuff because it has the police procedural, which I think is a lot of fun, because I love Stuart Whitman, first of all. Let's just put that out there. But
yes,
he's so good in it. But also it's got kind of a romance happening with David Hedison and Meredith Baxter. So it's got that aspect. It's got some pretty good like death scenes in it. So it's got all the kind of like scary stuff the kids like. And it also has this mature stuff happening with like the sexuality stuff that it's kind of exploring underneath everything. And so, yeah, I found it to be a really fascinating film. And I'm not surprised that Harrington came from that background of experimental filmmaking.
Yeah, this was just a weird thing is when I watched this about 3 or 4 days ago, it was a Saturday afternoon. And right before it, the past 2 months, I've been watching a James Bond film every Saturday afternoon. And I happened to watch Live and Let Die, which came out in 1973. And Felix Leiter in Live and Let Die is David Hedison.
That's right, yes.
And there's a sequence. There's a tarot card sequence, a very important tarot card sequence in Live and Let Die. Oh. Now, and so when I immediately sat down and watched this and I saw David Hedison, I said, Felix, what are you doing? Fooling around with Meredith Baxter. She's clearly too young for you, but I don't want to judge if everyone's okay. But then they have a tarot card sequence too.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. It was the year of David Hedison and tarot card sequences.
And that's interesting. I forgot about that because there's also a tarot card sequence in Night Tide.
Oh, I haven't seen Night Tide in if it came out on DVD, then I saw it. I think it was like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I saw everything 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's had this cult reputation for a long, long time. I finally saw it for the first time this weekend, and I was floored by how amazing it was. It's such a beautiful film. But now I'm seeing all these connections between those films, and it's kind of interesting. So he's even paying, I hate to use for homage, but he's sort of paying tribute to himself in a way with Night Creature. Because he's also got this kind of interesting character, Meredith Baxter. So in Night Tide, you know, is she or is she not a mermaid is the question, right? And it leads you a couple of different ways before the reveal, and I won't spoil that film. But in this movie, I guess we kind of figure out she's a part of it closer towards the end. And then, but there is this question, is she or is she not the cat creature, right?
Yes.
Through the full film. And then sort of in the last act, everything gets revealed. And we'll probably talk about that at some point.
Because, there is that moment where David Hedison's character is talking to, I forget his name, but he's talking to her. And he's asking her questions. And he discovers the more he talks to her, the more it seems that she has no family ties.
That's right. Oh, ha, ha, ha. See, I was taking you a face value there. Yay.
Look at all those connections. I feel like I'm on The Hysteria Continues.
It's my joke of the week. Although that's a pretty good joke. That might be better than some of Eric's jokes. Don't tell him.
I won't tell him.
But it's actually true in this. She doesn't have family ties because I won't say.
And I heard she loves Bernie, too.
She does, but that's going to be a year or two, but they'll have some trouble with network executives.
I love Meredith Baxter. This was a pretty early role for her. So at the time, she had actually just done Bridget Loves Bernie, which was what we were married David Bernie, made it even cooler. But like, so she had done the show and the show got canceled. And then she started doing a number of guest spots on television and started doing TV movies. Now, her career in the world of TV movies wouldn't really hit till the 90s in terms of like becoming a queen of the TV movie, maybe in the 80s. But this was like her first primetime TV movie, her first TV movie. Speaking of games by Curtis Harrington, I'm bringing this up because Gene Kearney wrote Games, and he also wrote Invasion of Carol Enders, which was the wide world mystery that Meredith Baxter starred in right before she did this. So she actually did one TV movie, but it aired in late at night. It didn't have a primetime airing.
Was that a shot on video?
Shot on video.
Okay, I remember that showing up on like Thriller Video VHSs or something. The Invasion of Carol Enders.
It's really good. It's really good. As a matter of fact, I think it's better than Games in terms of the kind maybe it's not. Yeah, I think it's better than Games. I'm getting all my gaslighting confused here, though. Because I watched him.
You're not getting your gaslighting confused. You're doing it just great.
Yeah, Gene Kearney I'm gaslighting everybody by doing confusing everybody. Gene Kearney wrote some Night Galleries, and I did some of the commentaries for Night Gallery that he did. And so I was watching all of his films, and there's some gaslighting in his episodes of Night Gallery. That's what's happening. That's why I'm getting them confused. But he also did The Invasion of Carol Enders, which starred Meredith Baxter, and which she's quite good in. And she really enjoyed kind of like traversing the landscape of television and doing all these different roles. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But she's so beautiful, even though I'm pretty sure that's a wig.
It's
a little big. And I'm not
sure. I even like kind of the fact that her front teeth are kind of larger than I remember them being.
She's cute.
I'm there for it. If I were Mr. Bernie, you know, I'd say, hey, what up? You know,
I'm sure he'd be happy to hear that.
Bridget loves Budnick.
That would be the sequel.
In a parallel world at Earth 4, Bridget loves Bud.
But anyway, just to get back to the film, Dan.
Sorry.
So anyway, Harrington, aside from David Hedison, Stuart Whitman, and Meredith Baxter, he really does filter the film with a lot of these really well-known actors from classic horror cinema. And I actually almost forgot David Carradine was in it until we started talking about that, because he just pops up and stuff and then disappears. That's his job.
John Carradine.
I'm sorry, not yes. David Carradine. Wow. How long have it been since I've been podcasting? A long time. Yes, John Carradine. And he just sort of like comes in and then is gone, you know. And doesn't really have a through, as far as I can remember now, with the film. But
No.
But that's what his job is, to show up and be cool and then disappear. And so, yeah, so it's got all these great B-movie kind of things happening in it. And I don't know what else to say about that. I thought it was great.
I was going to say Gail Sondergaard. I forgot that she was the Spider-Woman.
Yes.
I think that's kind of where I know her the best, where she went up against Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and she also hung out with the Brute Man in a movie. So that's kind of that's cool. That's some of those 30s, 40s stuff
Her as a later character actress, like we see her here. She was in an episode of Night Gallery called The Dark Boy. And she plays just kind of a spinster in that. And in this movie, I was kind of floored by her look. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about that, because Gloria Swanson also embodies this kind of aesthetic.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Harrington
yeah.
uses, except she's much smaller than Sondergaard. I think Sondergaard looked really tall. Gloria Swanson's like 5 foot. But so there's all these great character actors. It's really well paced. I really like the interplay between David Hedison and Stuart Whitman. And
yes.
You know, like, he's the cop and he's kind of open to stuff, but they need the archaeologist to come in, and he's willing to go there. And it made me think of I'm obsessed with this now. Why didn't I get a degree in demonology?
Yes. You know, I wanted a cryptozoology degree for about 20 years.
Why didn't we do it?
It's what I'm watching. I have it playing here right now. And the scene where they go to talk to Gail Sondergaard's character and Meredith Baxter drops the cat statue.
Oh, yeah.
It's really nicely shot, because you kind of get a close up of Gail Sondergaard. You get a four shot of all of them. But then whenever you see the two guys, they're kind of they're not on top of one another. But Stuart Whitman's in the front. David Hedison's behind him, and they're all nicely in focus. So it's like the mise-en-scène, as it were, is a little sharper than in some things of this sort. Although I will say, every time they go out the back door of the store, it's clearly the back door of a soundstage on a studio somewhere. So every time they go out, I think, okay, that's Warner Brothers. Where is that? I recognize that. Yeah, that's not a...
That reminds me of is so at the beginning, it opens with that girl that Hester's being really nice to.
Yes,
And she's like, "Ooh, what a great case! Well, I don't know, briefcase. Can I have that?" And whatever, or she offers it to her. So
she got a lot of hippie talk.
Yeah, so she takes the briefcase home, and she picks up a cat along the way. This beautiful cat, and then the cat like hypnotizes her to fall to her death, right? And then it somehow opens the case. And whatever it needs isn't there, I don't think. And so it's later, we talk about backlots. This is what made me think of it. There's a cop that's supposed to be watching.
Oh, Hester's he's antique, definitely on a backlot.
Antique, you know, store. And he's and the cat makes him fall asleep. So then when Hester goes in, she ends up getting killed or whatever. And so it's like, okay, wait, the cat can make you go to sleep. Why did it have to kill the first girl? Like, I don't understand why I decided to kill her and let the cop live. That doesn't seem fair to me.
Yeah, I guess it did have to get Meredith Baxter in. Oh, I don't know. I don't, I guess if the cat seems pretty omnipresent. So, I don't know. Those black cats, they're crazy, aren't
they? They're crazy. They're not thinking through.
They're not thinking through. I had the cat that was my friend for 18 years, Lobo the cat. She was a black cat. She was a sweetheart, named after Lobo from Bride of the Monster. And she was a sweetheart. And she never did anything to make me want to jump off my roof. She was very nice in that when she was a doll. She was
meticulously planning it. It's just she never got around to it. You're right, though. You're right, though, because for her, Meredith Baxter couldn't have gotten the job there if she was still alive, right? So that actually makes sense to me now that I think about it. So thank you for talking this through with me because I was.
Yes, and may I bring up my favorite guy in the movie?
Yes,
the coroner.
Oh, he's great.
He reminds me. There was a guy back in the 40s or 30s called. He was in. I want to say his first name was Skeleton, but I didn't write down. But he was a guy. He showed up in Dick Tracy versus Cue Ball, and he's in a bunch of other movies. And he's this creepiest. Maybe this is him. I gotta look now. But it was this. He was this. And whenever I see him, I think, oh, it's that guy. And then I think, Dan, look him up before you record the podcast. Oh, shit. I didn't. So but that coroner is so great because he's got this sort of eternal coroner look, but there was also this actor that looked exactly like this guy from the 30s or 40s.
This movie is full of atmosphere. You know, it's got these really great characters and he had this really sallow sunken in face and this didn't he have like a British accent and he was very droll and serious and
the one thing he didn't do was like eat a sandwich, which is modern day.
I
like
wait for that. I always wait for that. But that makes me think of just the film itself. It's LA, but it's like LA if LA was like in London because it's very cloudy and kind of urban looking. And it looks different than how I remember LA. You know what I mean? Like they shot it in these kind of like you're saying the backlots are great because they have this kind of grayish quality to the buildings, and it seemed like it was cloudy out, and so it had a really nice kind of drizzly, old dark housey kind of feel to it that I really liked.
Yeah, it's nice because it does have that. No matter where you sort of go in the movie, it kind of has a bit of that overcast, like you said, old dark house and James Whale kind of feel to it. And then you get those little random scenes that you don't expect, like the scene where all the cats are leaping over the wall.
Oh yeah.
I don't know how they did that. I don't want to know how they did that, but there was just something about like when Meredith Baxter is facing us and you just see like dozens of cats fly over this wall.
That's right.
Like, that it's so, it's overwhelmingly good, but it's also like, I don't want to know. Don't tell me how the cats. Don't tell me how I did it because it's so good.
It's the 70s and I don't want to hear about it.
Exactly.
There's this, he puts a lot of effort into this film, you know, to kind of make it like kind of stylized and sort of his own. And I'm not saying that other TV movie directors don't do that, but a lot of them don't. And, you know, like they make good films, but like, I feel like now the more that we're talking about it, the more I'm seeing Harrington's signatures, you know, that we were seeing in his other films as well. And that's fascinating to me.
He's really good at lining up the characters and getting them in space. Like the, when they go to the hotel and Key Luke is dead in in the bed. And you get the shot where John Carradine, the little lady whose name I forget, who sits on the couch. I love her so much. And like another guy, I don't even know who this guy is. Like they're all looking in, and the framing for a TV movie is pretty gorgeous. It's like, that's really nice, you know. And it's and he does that. If you're watching a scene and you're thinking, I'm not fully caught up in this movie, look at the way he frames stuff. Look at the background. Look at the setup of everything. He's generally, something is happening.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the little person that plays the woman sitting on the.
Sorry, I don't know her name.
I don't either. She's sitting on the countertop at the hotel, and
gosh, yeah.
And what I like is that he does, like, as much as he's kind of developing the three main people and Hester, you know, kind of going about their day to day and trying to figure out what's happening, he pays equal attention to the characters that come in and out of their lives.
Yes.
To give them kind of, you almost feel like each one had a very concrete backstory when they came on to play the part.
Yes.
And so it's got, like, it's certainly not a realistic film, but I think that it helps to anchor the craziness of it, to have these mm-hmm. characters that they've, it feels like a universe that exists somewhere.
Yes. Yes. And I think if the movie were made in that universe, David Hedison and Stuart Whitman would be the squares.
Yeah.
And everyone else would be just the regular people doing their things. Like I said, like when you see John Carradine and the lady sitting there, and she says to them, like, hey, big guy, you want? And I was like, yeah, I'm interested. How are you? What's going on? Hey, how are you?
Oh,
yeah,
I love
and
it's her.
Like,
she's great.
It's just this. It's funny. I've said this before with TV movies, but the thing I love about TV movies that I didn't expect when I got into them is that there are ones like this that you kind of want to. I don't want to get killed by a cat, and I don't think I would. But you kind of want to hang out there for a while.
Absolutely.
You kind of want to be in this space. It's like, I recognize the space they're in, but it's slightly askew. I mean, I think, I don't know for certain, but the house that Kent Smith pulls into in the opening,
mm-hmm.
like the big mansion, that looks like the house from Appointment in Fear.
Oh.
That looks like, now I haven't seen Appointment in Fear in a while, and it's not like anyone's caring to put out Appointment in Fear on DVD or Blu-ray or anything, but I've seen that film four or five times, and when he's pulling up into the mansion and it has kind of like the curvy driveway with the white walls, and I was like, is that the Appointment in Fear mansion? It could be, but and I hope it is.
I love that girl's apartment, the first victim, the second victim.
That house, yeah, that house. Oh. I think I've seen that. It's a gorgeous, and it's like a almost a Baroque kind of house. Like, it almost looks like a puzzle house. Like if someone were to, you know, flick a switch, like each of the floors would move, you know, like in one direction, the other direction, and suddenly everything would be in a different place.
It's just such a beautiful location work, and really capturing like LA in a like the seedy underbelly of it in like this really cool way. Yeah, there's just so much to love about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But now all I keep thinking about is the cat killing the girl. And now it makes sense to me, and I feel stupid for even bringing it up.
Oh, that's why I got in charge of the edit button. I'm kidding, folks. We're gonna leave that in. I've said enough stupid stuff on this podcast that we'll leave that one.
No, but it all makes sense. The whole movie makes sense now. It all works for me. But yeah, there's just a lot of terrific, like, little things that are in it that help it create its own universe. And it's a really great, I don't want to call it a monster movie. And is it an animal attack? I guess it is movie.
Yes, I think, because they always say that the people are killed by, like, cat claws and things. So I would say it. I don't even know. I don't know, and I don't think it cares.
Yeah, it probably doesn't, because it does have a monster in it.
Yes, I mean, I think when you got, what, Robert Block?
Yeah.
I've never said his name. Yeah, Robert Block.
I
didn't
either. I just say Block.
Robert Block writing it, Curtis Harrington directing it. I think you're in a it's like Bride of Frankenstein, you know, like when Bride of Frankenstein came out, I don't think anyone expected that.
Yeah.
For the sequel. I mean, when you watch that and you're like, the guy's got the little people dancing and test tubes.
Yes, right.
And all
so good, yeah.
And it starts off with Mary Shelley saying, I'm going to tell you a tale, you know, and it's Elsa Lanchester. You don't – I think this is one of those movies where you don't – I think people watching it on the day, you know, who are maybe like, you know, I'm going to – I don't know. What were they watching at that time? I guess we're not watching All in the Family or Sanford and Son tonight. We're watching Cat Creature. But I think it's one of those movies that can – if you can forgive the fact that it does look very 1973, I think that's the best part. But I think you can enjoy it forever.
Forever. That's your quote. They're going to put that on the top of the video box when it comes out.
Yeah, I think Stuart Whitman, of course, in about four years after this, he's in one of my all-time favorite Italian. It's not a giallo, and it's not whatever the cop show movies are. The Polizio.
Oh, yeah, I'm not even going to try to say it.
Yes.
Policetti something.
Yes, Blazing Magnum. Shadows in an Empty Room, the one with Tisa Farrow, Mark Landau. He's in that one, and he's the exact same character. He just goes into every scene, whether it's with a group of students, with a bunch of professors, with a bunch of cross-dressers. He beats them all up and yells at them.
That's what you do when you're Stuart Whitman.
Stuart Whitman, and he kind of does that here, which is fun.
So I'm going to want to get into the background so we can have Nate for the second film, but do we want to say anything about the ending, or do we just want to leave it hanging?
Let's leave it hanging.
Okay. So let me just tell you a little bit about the film then, real quickly. So Dan mentioned we're tuning out of All in the Family, but let me tell you what it actually ran against. You're close. You're in the time frame. But it ran against on CBS Hawaii 5-0 and an airing of Shaft, which that's difficult to pass up. And on NBC, it ran against two short-lived series, Chase, which I think starred Peter Graves, but I'm not positive, and The Magician, which, of course, starred Bill Bixby, which was a great show.
One of my favorites, yeah.
So now, this movie aired the same season as Killer Bees. It did not do as well in the ratings. It got a 16.8/27, coming in at number 102 for the season out of 237 TV movies. So it's in the top half, which is good. But not as good as the other film. We'll talk about that. But like I mentioned, Meredith Baxter was just starting to dive into character roles and guest spots. And she said about The Cat Creature that she took the movie basically because she'd been married to David Burney. And they actually had two kids, which she brought with her into her marriage with David Burney. So she would have been married prior to that, I think. And they had these kids that they were trying to take care of while they were both pursuing acting careers, and they needed some help around the house. And so The Cat Creature kind of paid for that, she said, in interviews. And she said, quote, also, she said this about the role, quote, "The Cat Creature let me play everything from a mummy to a cat to a girl in a terrible red rig to a pile of dust. And how often do you get a crack at parts like that?" End quote. She then went on the next year to star in a movie with her mother titled Stranger with My Face. At the time that they were making that movie, its original title was My Father's Smile, which I didn't know. And that's a pretty good TV movie. You can find it usually on Amazon Prime. And Gail Sondergaard. So what I have to tell you about Gail Sondergaard is that she actually won the very first Best Supporting Actress Academy Award ever in 1936 for a movie she made called Anthony Adverse. So this is important.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is important. She was known for playing a villainess, which is probably why she was cast here as Hester. But a really neat thing happened while she was making The Cat Creature. So Sondergaard was still doing television at this point, and she was mostly in retirement. She would come out and do little roles like this. And she got called one day to come and do some shots on The Cat Creature, like pickup shots or something like that. And she showed up to the studio, and she walked into wherever they were filming it, and she was greeted by the press, Meredith Baxter, David Hedison, and Charlton Heston. And so when they originally gave out Academy Awards, they didn't have an award like we know them now, like the statue. They had plaques. And she never had gotten a physical statue. And Charlton Heston gave her the statue on the set of The Cat Creature with the press there, taking photos and stuff. And I just thought that was so cool that, like, they were there, Meredith Baxter, some 25-year-old actress, you know what I mean? Hanging out with Gail Sondergaard and, like, watching her get her actual statue, which is such a neat story. So, and I'm sure Curtis Harrington was just tickled about that. David Hedison at the time was probably best known for starring in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and, of course, The Fly. I didn't realize this. His wife, who I think her name was Bridget Hedison, she worked on television as well. She worked on The Colbys. And she worked on Dynasty. And their daughter, interestingly enough, who looks a lot like David Hedison, is a photographer. But I was shocked to see that she is married to Jodie Foster. So, like, that was just so cool. So I looked her up, and she looks a lot like her dad, and it was really cool to see that. She seems very happy. Hedison, as you mentioned, worked in To Live and Let Die, and of course, he reprised the role of Felix Leiter in 1989's License to Kill, which involves a shark attack, if you remember his scene in that. And that's why I brought that up, because it's shark related and I loved it. He was really only in a handful of TV movies, but he also appeared in Romance Theater's The Awakening of Cassie with PJ Souls. And so that makes him the coolest person on the planet. Stuart Whitman, I wanted to mention, Stuart Whitman was actually interested in the occult and the supernatural. And at the time that he was making The Cat Creature, he was actually writing a script that never got produced titled Russian Hill, which he said was about the occult. He said he'd personally experienced ESP, and that he believed in all that stuff. So we covered this on the podcast. I don't think Nate was with us, but do you remember, Dan, we did that movie Revenge with
Oh
him and
yeah.
Shelley Winters and Bradford Dillman? And he did some supernatural stuff in this era. He did a ghost story, he did some night galleries. And so I think he was really drawn to that stuff. So having him in this film just kind of fits, because he was really open to all that. But the story, interestingly enough, was by Douglas S. Kramer, who was also a producer. And that name might sound familiar to you because he did a lot of stuff with Aaron Spelling,
Oh yes.
including creating Love Boat, Fantasy Island, TJ Hooker, etc., etc. He also produced over 20 Daniel Steele adaptations. His stepfather actually was an executive at Paramount, and at the age of six, Kramer had a subscription to The Hollywood Reporter. So he was very interested in film and television from a very young age. He also created Peyton Place, or he developed it from the film. He ended up working on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, which of course starred David Hedison, and he produced Bridget Loves Bernie, which of course starred Meredith Baxter. So you can see where he's getting his cast from. Lucy Arnaz worked with Douglas S. Kramer on the TV movie Who is the Black Dahlia, which is an excellent film. And Arnaz called him, quote, a conscientious and classy producer who gave some of the most warm and elegant parties in Hollywood. He was the consummate host, end quote. Interestingly enough, Douglas S. Kramer co-founded the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art. So if you're ever going to LACMA, just remember that that was partially founded by the guy who created Love Boat. And of course, he worked really heavily in the TV movie, and we will talk about that here in a minute. And Robert Block, of course, as Dan mentioned, did the teleplay. So he, like Harrington, was really into movies when he was a kid, and that grew kind of a fascination for the genre. And everybody remembers him, of course, for writing the novel for Psycho. But he did work on television. He did Night Gallery. He worked on Dark Room, which is a great anthology series from the 80s. Tales from the Dark Side. He did Monsters. He wrote The Dead Don't Die, of course, which Harrington also directed. But Kramer also worked with somebody named Wilford Lloyd Baums, who doesn't have a large filmography, but he worked on a lot of these things that we've been talking about. But between him and Kramer, they made a gazillion TV movies, including Dawn, Portrait of a Teenage Runaway, Who's the Black Dahlia, Search for the Gods, Cage Without a Key, Dr. Cook's Garden, and A Death Among Friends, which is excellent, by the way. That's kind of a female Columbo riff. I think it was a pilot film. And he also worked on Love Boat. The reviews of the movie were that the story was good, but it was Harrington's use of the character actors that made the film worthwhile. That's what John O'Connor of the New York Times said. Kevin Thomas of the LA Times said much the same thing. He thought the film was, quote, so much fun. So I think I had some okay, yeah. So October 13th, 1973 was when newspapers started writing about the production of The Cat Creature. So that means it was produced in early October and aired in December, which means it had a 2-month turnaround, which is pretty common for these TV movies. We talked about Crowhaven Farm. I think that had a 2-month turnaround, as did Monsters and Mazes. And I think that that is my background. And do you guys have anything you want to add?
I don't think so.
Nate?
I like cats.
So do I.
I do too. I love cats. So anything with cats, I will watch. But I think you're right, Dan. Just real quick, it's really hard to make cats scary, and people periodically try to do it, and it never quite gets there. I think that there's a pretty scary cat in Strays, but it's a cute film, is what it ends up being. They're
Yes.
just cute, and they can't help it.
Even like, say, Night of a Thousand Cats, where the guy has like a cellar full of cats that he feeds people to. Even that's like, maybe not. Or The Uncanny. Is that the cat anthology? Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also, of course, The Uninvited. Is that Burt I. Gordon? I can't remember who made that. No, it's not Burt I. Gordon. Who did The Uninvited?
The ghost movie?
No, the cat movie with Alex Cord and George Kennedy and Clu Gulager about the boat with the mutant cat that lives.
Oh, that's the it is The Uninvited, isn't it?
Yeah, it's with, by the guy who did Joysticks. It's
Graydon Clark.
Graydon Clark, that's right. Yeah.
Yes, with the cat with the demon.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
But let's dive into Killer Bees because I love this movie and I have a couple things I want to say about it.
I'm just going to say really quick, this is about a guy named Edward Von, I've got his name here, Bolin, who brings his fiance, who also is having his child named Victoria Wells, back to his big family's big estate. They're into wine. And while they're, everyone there is male except for the leading, the madame, who's played by Gloria Swanson, who is kind of the matriarch over all of them. And the movie is basically, you can't really say much about it without giving too much away, but basically Madame rules over the guys. She's rather wary of Victoria, and Madame also controls lots of bees. And the bees seem to protect her and the family. And I don't want to go too much more into that because it's you learn more and more about the family as you go, and you learn that the bees are an integral part of everything they've done, and that Madame seems to kind of control them, and maybe Victoria is. I'm going to stop there, actually, because I'm going to give things away. Yeah, there's not much you can say. Plot-wise, this is a tricky one. But it's just basically, guy goes back to see his family, very sort of Edgar Allan Poe-y, kind of goes back to see his family and the estate and brings his gal, and there are bees and an old lady. I'll stop there.
That was the original, back of the box, right? There's a bees and an old lady.
Yes.
And it's scary. Yeah, so I'm ashamed to admit it. My first viewing of this movie was just a few months ago when we were doing the tarantulas commentary, because I was trying to watch all the Animal Amok, Killer Bee, Killer Bug films that are available. And there's a lot of them that are made for television in this era. And I sat down to watch this and I was expecting to enjoy it because of the cast, but I was blown away by how amazing this film is and how I don't think it's had a home video release. And that's criminal to me because for me, this is, and I'll talk about it later because I want to hear your opinions. This is a perfect genre telefilm as far as I'm concerned. And it's okay if you guys didn't love it as much as me, but from what I do in my lectures and talking about what comprises these kind of films, this film is perfection. Perfection. There's not one thing wrong with the film. It gets it all right. And I'm blown away by it. But Dan, had you seen this before?
No, I hadn't because I misread the list you sent me.
Yeah. And I watched I sent you the wrong title.
Okay, because I remember when we were doing the Tarantulas commentary, you said, you saw Killer Bees? And I said, yeah, I have. And then I paused and said, no, I saw Savage Bees.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, so and I really enjoyed it. I will say the one thing that keeps it from perfection for me is that I honestly think if this had been like – what's that one we love with the mud monster?
Oh, The World Beyond.
Yes, which is like a 50-minute one. I think if this had been like 50 minutes, it would have been perfection for me. I just think it's a little bit – I just think there hits a point where I thought, okay, I get where we're going. Now go there. And then it just goes on a scene or two too long. I don't dislike it, though. I've seen plenty of things that have – extra scenes and stuff like that. But that was my only thing with it. I really enjoyed it, but I thought if it were maybe 15 minutes shorter, I would, this would probably be one of my favorite things. But as it is, I really enjoy it. Gloria Swanson is nuts. Oh. Kate Jackson is adorable and eerie. Edward Albert, every time I look at him, I see, you know, Eddie. And I've seen pictures of his mom, so I see the two of them together. Every time I can't stop seeing the two of them together. I think it's a really, I think part of it is like at a time when the disaster films and things were building, because this is still relatively early in this time, to do such a intimate version of it is I thought when you get to the end and you're like, oh, I get it, then you go watch it again and you're like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing, and it becomes even better. So I think it's I quite like it. I don't know if I like as much as Cat Creature, but I quite like it.
Cool. Okay. Nate, had you seen this before?
No. Like Dan, I watched Savage Bees.
Yeah. Which I didn't watch. I gave you...
Which I love.
I sent really you the right Savage title, Bees. But then I went ahead and watched this one.
But I know Savage Bees was great. But Killer Bees, yeah, it wasn't what I was expecting. I was expecting, you know, basically... Killer Bees type film, as far as, you know, like Savage Bees or like Ants,
right?
Where it's just people being like, I guess, kind of picked off by these bees. But then as soon as I met Gloria Swanson's character, I'm like, oh man, this is going to be something totally different from what I'm expecting. You know, she is just, you know, she is amazing in every scene that she's in. Yes. She just has this huge presence, you know, and like she definitely, you know, takes on the matriarch role of her family. And I loved Kate Jackson in this because her character, Victoria, I like the scenes between her and Madame.
Yes.
Because I felt like Victoria was trying to understand her, but Victoria wasn't like a pushover.
No, yeah.
She wasn't at all. Like, she stood up for what she believed in. She said what she thought, even if it was disagreeing with Madame. And I thought that was pretty awesome that, you know, she didn't, you know, just go along with everything happening or anything that the family said. She didn't just go along with it, I guess, to be nice. Like, she had her own voice, and I love that. And... I don't want to give away the ending, but I will say this. She was amazing in the ending. She was so good.
Yes, she was.
I loved her.
She's so good. So Kate Jackson, you know, I've always loved her, but I've you know, my experience with her is mostly Charlie's Angels and maybe Satan's School for Girls and some later TV movies. But here, she just shines. Like, you can see that thing inside her that makes her such a great actress. It's just right there for the world to see, for like a really good early glimpse. Because I think Charlie's Angels was still a year or two away from this. She was on The Rookies, but like, you know, she was really like standing her ground in this film and like kind of making a name for herself, I think, as an actress. And she's a powerhouse in it. And it's really interesting because she's a powerhouse in the exact opposite way that Gloria Swanson's a powerhouse, because Gloria Swanson is like chewing the scenery in a great way. She's, you know, she's being meticulous about the part, but like, also there's like a big thing about it. She's larger than life, even though she's the tiniest person in the film. Whereas Kate Jackson is kind of bringing it down and making her sort of presence really subtle, but it's clearly felt and strong. And so these two together, like you were saying, their scenes together are amazing. And one thing that I think Kevin Thomas of the LA Times said was that the men in the film were fine, but this movie's about the women. And I was nodding my head while I was reading it, because so for me, with the things I talk about when I talk about like these early TV movies are like the things that they did. And one thing is, and I've mentioned this before, and so I'm sorry I'm repeating it, but you know, the most important demographic for networks was women aged 18 to 49. So they tried to cater a lot of these films to that. And by doing that, they kind of were looking at what women were doing in the real world and then putting it into these films. So you would see these kind of like a lot of second wave feminism. You also saw a lot of characters that were housewives, blah, blah, blah. Another thing that TV movies like to do was that they can't really do a lot of things that theatricals can do in terms of like sexuality or violence. So they made a lot of movies that kind of rested on the gothic, because the gothic can be under the radar sexy or under the radar scary, and it doesn't necessarily cross any lines with the FCC or the networks or anything. And this movie's got a very gothic atmosphere to it, and at the house, and it's got that sense of melodrama that you find in gothic films. And it's about the family, which is probably the most important aspect of the TV movie all across the board. Like, there are lots of TV movies that aren't about families, but I would say the majority of them are about families falling apart, families coming together, families beginning, families ending. It's always about the family. And now for Elaine Rapping, who wrote this really wonderful book called Movies of the Week, she talks a little bit about, in the drama, the TV movie, the family always has to be stronger at the end of the film. And that's almost always correct. But that's not necessarily the case in genre films. And she doesn't talk about genre films in her book at all. Well, she talks about melodrama as a genre, but not like horror or suspense or action, or thrillers or any of these things. And so this movie has all of these elements that people have written papers on, yet nobody's like written about this film. It's like a perfect example of how you make a great classic ABC movie of the week and have it fit all of those little holes that the networks are trying to fill in. And not only do that, but make it an amazing film. And so I'm floored by this movie. I'm floored by it. I think it's excellent. And it doesn't mean it's the best movie ever made necessarily, but I think it's really fucking good. And I think that it's doing everything that makes me so excited about what TV movies are doing. And so it's a perfect example for anybody who's interested in exploring the world of made-for-TV movies. And if you listen to my lectures or if you listen to me talk about them here and you want to see a really good example, this is the film. This is probably the best film you can see that does that. And so I'm ashamed that I'm just now seeing it, because I would have incorporated it into my talks by now. And now I want to go out and lecture. I'm going to go on a circuit starting tomorrow. I'm going to hit all the major cities and we're going to talk about this film, because it's so vitally important to me. But so that's why I love it. And I agree with Dan. Like, I don't necessarily agree. I mean, I think it's fine with all the scenes and everything. But, and I can see people watching it and being like, Amanda, this is not the best movie ever made. But like, but it just does so many things right. You know what I mean? And I get excited just thinking about this film. It's perfect for me. So I might overdo it, but that's what I'm here for. So
I was going to say, when I got to the end of it the second time, and suddenly it all clicked in what the movie was doing, and I was like, oh my gosh, wow, that's really good. Wow. Did I still think it was a little long? Maybe. But it was just like, the movie, what it's doing is so wonderful and crazy at the same time.
Yeah.
And so when you get to the end of it, and there might be people who are smarter than me, you watch it the first time and you go, oh, I get it. Okay. But I didn't see it the first time. I saw it as sort of just a matriarch-led house full of guys. But then the second time I was like, oh, wait, bees. Okay, I get it. And it was just like, wow, this is really good. So like you said, it's one of those things where I could point to a half a dozen TV movies that I think are much better than this. But this – it takes up a through line and it follows it all the way through really nicely. And when you get to the end, you're like, oh yeah, well done.
You lean back with your cigarette.
Exactly. Yeah. A cigar, a pipe, whatever, you know, it's just like, yeah.
And I mean, this movie is most famous because Gloria Swanson's in it, and she let somebody put like 300 bees on her. And it made the papers because of that. But it's so much more than that. And when Gloria Swanson made the movie, and I won't read the entire, she did some interviews to promote the film, which was amazing. And she talked a lot about how she created the character. And there's some, it's such a collaborative, and that doesn't happen a lot with TV movies because they had a very short shooting schedule. They go in, they've got to make this genre film, and then they leave and they go on to the next project. But she really thought of a lot about the character. She created the accent. But one of the things she did that I love, so I don't know if you noticed, his name must appear in the credits, but Joel Schumacher was the production designer.
Oh, yes. I saw that.
Yeah. And so it turns out he did her costumes. and everything. And he developed the character with her in a way. So she talked to him. They did it all by the phone. She said she really liked working with him. They helped develop her style. But one of the things they did, and I didn't even think about it until I watched the movie after I read the interview, but she's got those Princess Leia buns at the beginning.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
it's honeycomb, right? She's
Oh,
trying to
that's
make
right.
those look like honeycomb. And then if you'll notice at the end of the film, and this is where we start to get a little spoilery, Kate Jackson has worn her hair long through the whole film until the very last scene where she has it back in a bun. And she hasn't
Yes.
quite gotten it as twisty as Swanson's hair, but you can see the honeycomb starting to develop.
But she's the younger version, so she's
Yes.
yes, yeah.
Yes, and it's such a neat little subtle thing.
It's the film is once like I said once you catch exactly what they're doing, go watch it again, and you just like wow, it's one of those kind of
Yeah,
movies,
just like there was so much thought put into all these little things that are happening in the movie. And again, like what I love about it is that there's also a mimicking of the house. There's the house, and then there's
Oh,
the little
yes.
tiny house that the bees live in, right? And it looks like their house. And it's just this beautiful little thing where they're intersecting the bees and the family and what it means, and are the bees part of the family, right? And
Yes.
what they mean. And there's this whole story too that Gloria Swanson tells about how they ended up in America, right? And how they brought the bees with them. And
Oh,
there's
yeah.
this loyalty, right? And she puts the bees on her finger and says,
Yes.
"I love you." And like she's so bold in the role, but like so she anyway, but she had a I don't know how big of a hand she played in like her character total, like what was written and what she brought, but in terms of the aesthetic and these little touches, she really did so much more than just put a bunch of bees on her,
Yes.
you know?
I want to say with her, I know her next thing was Airport 75, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And in that was meant to be a TV movie, but
Oh, I didn't know that.
it became a theatrical, I don't know, at the last minute. I don't think you could do that at the last minute, but it was originally a TV movie. But they decided to make it into Airport 75, but it came out in 74, and Gloria Swanson plays herself, and she spends basically the whole movie just sitting talking about herself
That's
to
right.
a woman next to her. And it's ultimately one of those, it's such a goofy movie.
It's great though. It's
But
my favorite of the airport.
I love it's my favorite is 77, just because I love that they go underwater.
Water. Yeah, that's
But
a crazy
I
one.
adore, and I love geez, I forget her name. I'll remember in a minute, but there's an actress in that I love. The one that was in the first Columbo, one of the first Columbos, what's her
Lee
name?
Grant?
Yeah,
Oh, I
she's in
love
that.
her. Yeah, she's
She's so good
fantastic.
in that, where she's so good in that. And it's Jack Lemmon. But Airport 75, yeah, Gloria Swanson just sits talking to a woman telling her life story. So
Yes.
it cuts from everyone else to her just talking about herself, playing
She's
herself.
writing a biography and she's
Yes.
talking about how she used to either date or hang out with Howard Hughes. And
Yes.
she talks about his plane and she's like, and we did loop de loops. That's what I remember
Yeah.
her saying in the movie. Oh, I love it.
And the moment the plane is going down, it's like, make sure you save the tapes or whatever.
Yeah,
Make
that's
sure you
right.
put those in the black box kind of thing. But it's like when I see her in this, I think, oh, a little bit later, I always wonder if like she had been hired to do that when it was still a TV movie, or afterwards when it became a theatrical. I don't know, but that's when I see her in this, I think, oh, she's in Airport 75 next. I want to watch that again. With Norman Fell and Conrad
Oh my God,
Bain
Charlton Heston.
was it Norman Fell, Conrad Bain, and one of the dads from Seinfeld, who yells at the one who yells at everyone, where they play the three drunk guys who just sit there the whole time
Is
drunk.
that the
Mental
one
Bounds. Yes, yeah. And just sit the whole time drunk. And they yell at Myrna Loy.
That's what I was gonna say. Isn't Myrna Loy like passed out while the plane's going down?
No, it's one of the guys who's
Oh,
passing.
okay.
Myrna Loy is sitting next to Sid Caesar, and she's having Boilermakers.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes, Airport 75, everyone. If you haven't seen it, you have to watch it. 2, 3, 5. You will have a great 2 hours of life.
It would be an interesting double feature with this movie because Gloria Swanson. Yeah. The thing that I got from reading interviews with her, because she did actually set out to promote this film, which was a big deal, and she did a couple of press conferences, which were huge, it looks like, but she seemed surprisingly approachable, you know, because I think of her in Sunset Boulevard, I mean, she was a silent film actress, which I think brings a lot to the role here, because she was able to over-articulate things, but also, mm-hmm. like, not overdo the part, you know what I mean? Like, she was able to make it big, but without stepping over a lot of lines, you know? And I think maybe her background helped with that, but I was reading these interviews with her, and she was, like, that Airport 75 character. She liked to talk a lot about her life and her thoughts on the world, but she also seemed really kind of warm. And I wasn't expecting that, because I'm used to her in movies like this, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. she's not Madame von Bolin is not a particularly warm person. Yeah. And so she's just really interesting. And the fact that she cared so much to come into this little, what probably a lot of people considered a throwaway TV movie, mm-hmm. and to do which the tremendous work that she did in it is like astounding to me. And it makes me love her. And she actually said in interviews that she found that her younger fans were actually really cool, and that she kind of liked hanging out with them more because she felt like she was sort of young at heart. And also mm-hmm. she was interested in a lot of stuff that was happening in the 70s in terms of conservation and the environment. She was really into the environment. So was Edward Albert, who played Victoria's boyfriend in this.
Yeah, Eddie Albert was one of the people who got DDT banned. His home in the Pacific Palisades was an enormous mansion that had a huge garden, just like in I was going to say the British sitcom The Good Life, but just sort of like a Green Acres kind of thing. And that's the way, and I think Edward grew up in that.
Yeah, it's so cool. So I think that they probably got along really well. And also, this is the movie that Kate Jackson met Edward Albert, and they became quite the item. And they also starred in Death Cruise together.
Oh, yes.
Which we covered on the show. Yeah. So, like, this movie has a lot of stuff happening in it. And Curtis Arrington said later that this was one of his favorite films to make. And I think I can see why. Mm-hmm. Because even though I'm looking at it from, like, a subtextual marketing blah, blah, blah work approach, I mean, I think he knew he had something really solid, you know, when they handed him the script. Which, by the way, we'll talk about the two people who wrote it, but they were a married couple who had doctorates.
Oh, wow.
So we're talking about two PhDs coming in and writing this terrific little film. And so I think a lot of the stuff that we're talking about was absolutely intentional. You know what I mean? I don't think like I'm reading anything into the film. I think there's a lot of thought.
I think it's very much to me, like I mentioned, like Bergman earlier. You watch some Ingmar Bergman films or films of that like, and you sit there and you watch them going, what's going on here? And then you get to the end and get a realization of what you've seen. And then you go back and watch it again. And it brings it all sort of to life, as it were. And that's kind of what this is. You sit there watching it the first time going, okay, who's this crazy old broad with the Princess Leia buns who's got the bees? And what's the lady from Charlie's Angels doing there? And who's that guy who kind of looks like Eddie Albert but looks also a little Spanish? I think Edward Albert, I think his mother was Spanish.
She was like a flamenco dancer.
Yes, Eddie Albert, yeah. And so there's this little bit of, I don't know what's going on there. But then you get to the end, and then when you realize what's going on, you go, okay, watch it a second time, and you can see that everything's there. It's one of those movies, I think.
Yeah, it's just, and you were talking about like how Harrington was able to like place his actors in these like really interesting shots and stuff. And
yes.
The shot I always think of in this film is when Victoria first goes into the attic, and it's just like a beehive.
Yes.
Yeah. And this amazing scene, you know, where she's just sort of framed in the middle of it. And matter of fact, the house itself is so beautiful. And you were talking about Hell House. And I know this isn't the same, but when you were talking about that, it made me think about how much I love films where you don't exactly know where you are in the house.
The geography. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of that here. And it's just natural because it's a big house and we're not really given a tour of it. And it's like that in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark as well. Like the kitchen's here, but I don't know where it is in proximity to the bedroom. And so I'm not sure where she is in the house right now, you know? And so like, and this movie kind of has that feel to it. And so when she's wandering around the corridors, and then she goes into, I don't know what you call that, the wine part, the cellar.
The wine cellar, though, yeah, the wine cellar.
Yeah, wherever that big part is where she runs into the sheriff, who, by the way, was Aston on Quincy, John S. Reagan, and I was dying because I love him so much. She's just kind of wandering this premises where you never really know what it is, but then at the same time, it's home, right?
And yes,
it's
yes.
such a weird feeling. Like, because it is so massive and it's so underexplored by us, you know what I mean?
For some reason I was watching it for a moment and I said to myself something like, "How this is kind of like South Fork, you know? We spent 14 seasons in South Fork, and we never quite figured out the geography of that. Even the season where they set the place on fire." You know, it was like we never quite figured out the geography of the place. Not that you need to, but sometimes it's nice to.
Yeah.
But you don't always have to. And that's the thing with the horror film, like with the Hell Houses, is you go through the same rooms over and over again, but it seems like things keep moving or something. So it seems weird. So this is kind of like that. It's like this is another world these people are in.
And this is totally off topic, but another movie I just rewatched it for the 100,000th time this weekend with a friend of mine is The Unnameable. Is that how?
Yes.
You don't, because somebody turns a corner and then all of a sudden they've disappeared.
Yes.
And they should be within shouting distance from the person that they left, but somehow they can't hear each other anymore. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It's jarring. So the house isn't quite like that. Like people don't turn corners and disappear, but you definitely don't know where you are at any given time. And it's so massive and it almost feels like it's going to eat you alive, which is ironic. Right. And so it's just part of what makes the film like so eerie and atmospheric and what it is, you know, it's just so beautifully done.
You never, and you never quite, and it's one of those films that never, it doesn't give you an answer. It just shows you what sort of the next round of this world does.
Yeah.
Sort of. So there's no solution. There's no, you come out of it going, okay, this is the next. And there'll be a sequel, Killer Bees 2, which will do kind of the same thing.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that because it's the next generation, right?
So yes,
still dealing with family here. And so and they say it all the time. Like there's a whole conversation between Gloria Swanson and Kate Jackson where they use the word, it's like a drinking game.
Yes, it's like a woman must have a family. You must have a family that you can cry, is something you can cry for or something.
Yeah,
like
she
that.
Talks she's... about like if you don't have a family, you're being selfish. You're to serve others and blah blah. Mm. And she's got this whole spiel and she does. I don't think she knows at that point that Victoria is pregnant.
Yes,
and
no,
when she finds
so.
Out,
so, yeah.
It goes.
Yeah, oh her. Boy, yeah. There's and there is that moment too that I really like where you realize sort of that. All the guys, I think, kind of know that this is it's happening again.
Yeah.
Where the physician brother says about like she's died, Madame has died after 50 years of torture of life. She has died, and then you think 50 years.
Well, then he says 70.
70 to 80. Then he
kind of changes it because then they say something else and then he says 70. Yeah.
Exactly. So then you realize that, wait a minute, okay, there's something a little weird going on there.
That's interesting. He said that. Yeah.
And then it's like, I don't want to spoil it, but I was going to say, I don't want to spoil it. But the rest of my point is the thing I don't want to spoil. So enjoy the first half of my point.
Yeah, it's hard. I don't know. I don't know how much we want to go into because the ending's so cool, and I have questions about the ending as well. So,
yeah, me too. Me too.
So I don't know. Should we just go there?
Sure. If you want, Nate, do you have time for a couple minutes on the ending?
Yeah, I've got a few minutes left, so okay. I can talk for a few more minutes.
Okay, let's just do it real quick. So just briefly, so Madame dies, and they have this funeral, and at the funeral, the bees show up to mourn her loss. And one of the altar boys accidentally kind of makes them go crazy by smacking the coffin.
That's why I was never an altar boy. They're idiots.
And so the bees end up chasing everybody, you know. And then while that's happening, whoom, that's the noise. And then while that's happening, Victoria's kind of like at the house and she discovers kind of what's been going on. And so the house is basically like a beehive, and at least the attic. And then I think, I can't remember if she passes out or not. And then she comes to and everything kind of calms down. But then Edward Albert comes home and she's there and she's just a little different, right? And she's got her hair in this bun and... And the
She seems
more at home. And the other brothers seem to be aware of what's happening. But it takes him a little, because he wants to leave. And she's like, we're not going to leave. We're going to stay here. This is where we are now. This is our home. And the cop comes back and he's trying to get, because she'd been helping him. Victoria had been helping the police officer with their investigation with some of the strange murders around town. And then it was clear that they weren't going to get anywhere. And I don't understand how the sheriff isn't privy to all this stuff when other people are. But anyway. And so he's like, forget it. I'm done. Just you do your thing. But what's so interesting about the ending is that, for me, is that we have a general idea that she's now become the matriarch of the family and also the queen bee. Yes. But what's so weird about it is in one of the very last shots, Edward Albert, who had originally had run from the family, smiles.
Yes.
And I can't figure out why. And I don't know if you guys have thoughts about that, Dan or Nate.
I mean, my thought was, because at first he's not smiling.
Right.
But I think once he sees like how she's settling in and how she really wants this, maybe I think he just, his love for her is just like, well, I can do this.
So I let's got this. Do it. Yeah, let's, we got one on the way. We can do another. Yeah, I like that.
Did you have any thoughts, Dan?
Oh, well, one of the thoughts I had is when the movie starts, it reminds me of the beginning of Dallas when Bobby Pam show up. And they arrive back and everyone is kind of against Pam and kind of, I think JR makes Pam miscarriage like twice in the first two seasons, you know, so they don't like, so to me, that's kind of what this is. It's almost like if Pam had been accepted, if Miss Ellie had passed and Pam had been accepted into the family, this would have been a moment where Bobby would have complete, because Bobby in the series never, even at the end, even in the new series, he's part of it, but he's not a part of it.
Right.
And so that's, and I know this is 4 years before Dallas Begins, but it looks a lot like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
I agree. Because they're in a convertible, which is exactly what Pam and Bobby were in. But this is very much to me, this is, I think maybe this is I think when she becomes the queen bee, if she's the queen bee and these are her drones, they accept it.
Yeah.
And they live and they're part of it, and that her next child will be a boy, and then she'll have another boy and maybe another boy, and those boys will meet some girls. Maybe we won't meet those girls, but they have some more boys, and then eventually we'll have another girl in 50 years from now, when Kate Jackson's character is where Gloria was.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so to me, I don't know if they say how long this winery's been going. They say it's been, the wines have been infused with honey for a while, which at first sounds like the best thing ever, and then 4 seconds later sounds something I never wanted to drink. But I think to me that's what this is. This is this home is a beehive, and when Gloria Swanson died, she got replaced. Obviously, she got replaced by Kate Jackson as the new queen, and these are the drones, and they will have more drones, although it'll be a little slower and right. stuff like that. And the reason why he's in it is because maybe it's I think maybe it's a just an ancestral thing. Maybe they've been here for 100 years, and him wanting to leave has been bested by the woman he loves, with her child, his and their child. Besting his wanting to get the hell out of there.
Yeah. No, I like your answer to that. That works for me. Yet again, you're explaining things to me. You're mansplaining.
I did it again. I try not to. I try to go in reverse where you'll just, you'll like my family ties joke. You'll go, ha ha. We'll just go whatever.
But it took me a second to get it. That's where I am. That's where I'm.
Have you guys seen Kate Jackson recently? She's not far off from the same age Gloria Swanson was in this movie. And I'm like, it's like a night and day difference. Really? People are look so much younger these days.
They do.
Yeah, I agree.
But they really do. Because
she's
it's
right
always
for
like
the sequel.
Because whenever I see David Jansen in something, and he's like, I'm 40 years old. And I thought, when I was 40 years old, I looked 25. So, David, you're doing some hard living. I'm older than 40 now, and I'm looking my mid-30s probably. But you guys,
you do look definitely younger than David Jansen.
Yes, sure, I don't know what the hell they were doing back then, but it hurt.
Is smoking?
Yes, exactly. I think so. Yeah, it wasn't like it just made you crusty or something.
Also, those weird Jell-O desserts they made you eat. Yeah. Like not regular Jell-O, but like weird dinner Jell-O that would have shit.
Yes,
in it.
They used to do that, right? They would do these weird gelatin.
That ages you.
Yes, folks, come on. And having a steak every night must do something to you, right?
Or yeah, I'm a vegetarian, so I'm not even gonna like consider.
I haven't had a steak in 20 years, so I don't know, but yeah.
But anyway, she should do the sequel because it's just time. For us to see what became of the Von Bohlens.
Yes. I feel bad that Edward Albert has passed.
I feel really bad about that because he was quite young. He was only 55, I think, when he died.
He was. And it was funny because in the last few years of his life, he took care of
his dad. And then he died a year later.
Yes, that was so weird. It was like when Eddie Albert died at age 98 or 100. 99. Yeah, it was just like we all thought he was 10 years younger, but he lied at some point. And then they found out he was 10 years older. And so he like died at 99, and then Edward died like a year later. It's like, oh wow, that's like, that's sad and sort of sweet and compassionate at the same time.
I don't know. He was really cool, and I miss him a lot.
I like
He did so many of these great films. I don't know if you guys have ever seen The House Where Evil Dwells.
Oh, I love The House Where Evil Dwells. That's so much fun with Susan George.
Yeah, when I was a kid, that movie played all the time, and I was so fascinated by it.
Yes. He was in The Yellow Rose, the Sam Elliott, Cybill Shepherd, Dallas ripoff.
Oh, I remember that.
He was in that, and he played his character was Hispanic. And I remember when I watched it, I thought, I don't know. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute, his mom was Spanish, so
that's fair play for once. Yeah,
that's fair play. But he was in that for the season, and he was really good in that too. But he was in a lot of fun stuff. Yeah,
yeah, he was great. He was a wonderful actor. And and I think is that all we have to say about this one before I go into the background.
I think so. I think so.
Because I might have to cut out. I'm afraid.
Of course.
Yeah,
of
I thought
course.
You
Very
might.
Sorry.
So that's
but,
okay.
It's great to have you back.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. It was fun.
It was. Yeah. And thank you for sharing your movie moments. Those were all great.
Oh, yes. Those are great.
Thank you very much. You. Just very quick before I leave, one honorable mention I'll give is to the jester scene in House on Sorority Row.
Oh, yes. I watched that over the weekend. I grabbed the Blu-ray. I watched that over the weekend. Oh, my gosh. Yep.
That's a beautifully shot movie.
Great movie. Yeah.
He's got a lot of scary stuff in it.
Yeah. Yeah, the toilet, the head. In the toilet.
Oh, yeah. That's awful. Anyways.
Dumpster comedy. It's all great. Yeah.
Yes.
You guys have a great night.
You too.
I can't wait to talk again.
We will
talk to you soon, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye. So let me just do the background real quick, and then we'll do our shameless self-promotion and let everybody go to bed. Okay, so if they're listening late at night. So, okay, this aired on February 26, 1974 on ABC. On NBC, it ran against Police Story, which was a very special 90-minute episode with Sal Mineo. And on CBS, it ran against an episode of Hawaii Five-0 and the TV movie Manhunter, which I meant to look up.
Oh, yes.
And I could be wrong.
I got it here, yeah.
It stars Ken Howard. But I think Quentin Tarantino wrote a review of that movie for the New Beverly's website.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't seen the movie yet, but I have it on VHS. It did have a VHS release. So if anybody is curious about that film, I think that's the one he reviewed. Go to the New Beverly's website and look for his review. And then he gives a whole thing about it. It's a very long piece.
Quinn Martin production, yeah.
Yes. And so
L.K. Jones, yeah.
This movie did really well in the ratings. It came in 11th for the week. It got a 24.9/36 and came in number 17 for the season. So I didn't explain the ratings again, and that's because I barely understand them myself. I
We
always
always,
go,
yeah.
yeah, I always go with the second number, which is the 36, which basically means that 36% of people with televisions who are watching TV that night, which would have been Tuesday, I think, right, tuned in to watch the Killer Bees. So that's means that doesn't mean the whole United States of America. That means 36% of people who were watching TV that night, but it also
Yes.
means more than one person probably watching the TV, right? So that's, so I don't know what that term comes into in terms of millions of people, but it's a lot. It's over a third of the television viewing audience. So this was shot in Napa Valley, and the locations in Napa Valley include Oakville, Rutherford, Yountville, and Calistoga. Like the cat creature, it had a very fast turnaround. It began production in 1973, and it aired just 2 months later. As I mentioned, Kate Jackson also did Death Cruise in 1974, which also starred Edward Albert, who was dating her at the time. They were a hot item for a couple of years. They were in all the papers. And of course, she was starring in Rookies at the time and was super close to Charlie's Angels, but hadn't huge phenomenal stardom hadn't hit her just yet. But of course, she was perfect for this because her television debut was in Dark Shadows. And of course, she appeared in the movie Night of Dark Shadows. So gothic,
Oh,
horror,
yes.
melodrama, that's all right there for her. And of course, Gloria Swanson began her film career at 19. She was actually discovered playing a bit part in a film in Chicago. And then throughout her career, she would do all kinds of stuff. She was kind of an entrepreneur, so she would go on to work in fashion design and cosmetics. The second act of her amazing career began in 1971 on Broadway when she performed in Butterflies Are Free, which is interesting because Edward Albert, starred in the film adaptation of that. The year before she did Killer Bees, she appeared on The Carol Burnett Show because she was a huge fan of Carol Burnett's impression of Norma Desmond from Sunset Boulevard. And she had a lot of fun doing that, she said in
Yes.
interviews. After she did The Killer Bees, like immediately afterwards, she went and spent the holidays with her son and then attended a 5-day Gloria Swanson Film Festival in Orlando, Florida. Yeah, this was her TV movie debut. So she did a couple of really long interviews, and I copied all of the text, but I don't feel like I'm going to read it because I feel like I've kind of gone over what she said without reading direct quotes. What I will say is that she really seemed to enjoy doing it. It was a pretty intense schedule. She said she worked long hours, but she got to create the character and she had a lot of fun with the costumes and apparently working with Joel Schumacher. And she was drawn to the script, she said. I will read this quote. She said, quote, "Well, I hate to wade through most scripts. They are so sordid and dreadful. The character of Madame von Bohlen, my part in this movie, intrigued me. She could be just as destructive as Nora Desmond, and I knew I had to work at it." End quote. So she was just really drawn to this, and it's amazing because she must have gotten some really interesting scripts over the years. But this one she was just drawn to, and she apparently really liked. I'm guessing it was a good set because Harrington had really fond memories of making it. And we've talked a little bit about Edward Albert. I think we covered everything that I said about his being an environmentalist, and you talking about his dad and everything. And of course, Craig Stevens plays one of the brothers as well, probably best known for playing Peter Gunn.
Oh, yes.
And the year he did this, he also did another great TV movie titled The Elevator, which put him alongside Swanson's co-star in Airport 75, Myrna Loy. And
Hey.
that's where a bunch of people get trapped on an elevator together. And it's a really great little disaster flick. Something you were talking about how they take these movies and then make them really intimate. The Elevator does that as well.
Oh, yes.
So
It's like hanging by a thread, the
you may want to see
two-part
that.
Irwin Allen movie. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
yeah.
And I've talked a little bit about John S. Reagan. I think that's how you say his last name, who played
Think so.
Astin on Quincy. He started his career working in army training films, but then he became a character actor and then he got his role in Quincy. He ended up starring in the soap opera Santa Barbara in the 90s first season. And the year he did Killer Bees, he also did Earthquake. So here's all the disaster movies coming to the forefront.
Great time.
And as I mentioned, this movie was written by a husband-wife duo. They were named John William Corrington and Joyce Hooper Corrington. Both of them had PhDs. Both of them would go on to work on soaps. They developed the soap Texas, which I remember watching when it originally aired. They
Huh.
worked on Search for Tomorrow, Capital, General Hospital, and One Life to Live. They also wrote The Omega Man and Battle for the
Really?
Planet of the Apes.
Yes. Oh, that's where I knew their name from.
Yeah, and the couple also wrote mystery novels together. I think he died. I feel like she's still alive. And he, John William Corrington, was also a lawyer and a professor. So they were really interesting, had a really neat background. Kevin Thomas of the LA Times loved Killer Bees. He completely understood it. He wrote, quote, Killer Bees, ABC's macabre Tuesday movie of the week, airing at 8:30 tonight, is one of those instances in which the story is so far out that it becomes inconceivable that any other star or director could bring it off. And Gloria Swanson, the one and only, and Curtis Harrington, specialist in the eerie and the sinister, are the perfect combination for Joyce and John William Corrington's spooky, ingenious tale. And like I said, he said the film, quote, belonged to the ladies, which I totally agree with here.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Howard Thompson of the New York Times called it a, quote, tedious, prolonged bore. So you didn't think it was tedious, but I think he also felt maybe there was a little too much happening there.
I can't fault the stuff that happens, but I also think that if it were tightened a bit – It's like, you know, I just recently watched the most recent James Bond movie, No Time to Die. I loved it. But at the end of it, I thought that could have been 20 minutes shorter.
Yeah.
So I think it's just.
I agree with you. I mean, I don't agree with you because I love the film as it is, but I can agree with somebody seeing it the way you see it easily. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't agree with the tedious, but I think he got that part where he felt like, well, maybe it could have been edited down or something. But critics would also compare it a lot to The Birds, which I see. I wanted to mention briefly about what was happening in the world of actual killer bees in 1973. So in 1973, newspapers were reporting on what they called killer bees, which were more aggressive bees from Africa than the domestic bees. They were more aggressive then. There was this worry that once they got here, they would ultimately change the face of agriculture. But that would take about 7 to 10 years for them to get here. About 15 years prior to these reports in 1973, Brazil had imported the bees from Africa to help with their declining honey production. And then the bees began to migrate to other places. What happened was that these bees were completely aggressive. They began stinging horses and people, and they were blamed for between 300 and 400 deaths, including 100 in the U.S. So that's when I guess there were just a smattering of them in the U.S. So that's where like the fear was coming from. But at the same time that this was happening, there was also a lot of newspaper articles about chemicals that were used for farming, killing a lot of the bee population. So there was this kind of yin and yang happening, like, oh my god, we have these scary bees coming, but at the same time we're killing bees and we're also destroying our own agriculture, you know what I mean? And so I don't think this film was born of that, but there it was actually killer bees were actually part of like our cultural landscape at this point.
Did you hear the story about the guy who left the bee hive open?
No.
This was
a joke where I'm gonna not get it and then I'll get
no, this is I told this story on an In Search Of related podcast with Rob Kelly a few years ago, but when we were talking killer bees. But no, there's a story where they imported the African killer bees into Brazil because they wanted to mate them with the other bees, and they had a whole bunch of killer bees in hives, and apparently one day one of the scientists went over there. Started opening up some of the things to check on everything and apparently left them open.
Yikes.
So the reason why the killer bees got out was because some jackass left the hives open. Mm-hmm. And it was basically came out a little while later and all the killer bees were gone.
Whoops.
And it was like, what the hell? And so that's kind of where the some of the craziness came from, is that there was like a swarm. I think that's Savage Bees. Does that.
Oh, interesting.
Savage Bees is about a Brazilian. Savage Bees is basically the TV movie variation of that, where a guy from Brazil comes up and says, yeah, we let a bunch of killer bees out and they're attacking New Orleans.
Zoinks.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's interesting. I didn't know that. So that makes sense that I was seeing these numbers of killer bee attacks. Now you've answered all my questions again, Dan. You've mansplained once again.
I did it once again, my In Search Of knowledge.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I appreciate that. We just got the box set, so.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, the full oh gosh, I love that set. It's so good.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I love that show. And that's kind of all the background I have, which is perfect. So I think what we can do here is we'll talk about what we've done if you want to catch up with us, and then I'll give our contact information. So
oh, sure.
I'll just briefly say I made a list of things that I think I haven't mentioned since the last time we recorded, but I know what the last episode we did was, but I don't remember really when it came out. And so I don't know. Jeez. I've done a lot. So so what you can look for is if you're interested in commentaries that I've done, I did Night Gallery season 2, which just came out, and they just announced Night Gallery season 3, which I just did some commentaries for, and I'm really excited about. With my friend Lance Vaughn over at Kindertrauma, I did a commentary for The Mysterious Island of Beautiful Women, which was a lot of fun, a really weird little TV movie that we both enjoyed. Also with my friend Sam Pancake, who also has a TV movie podcast, which I can never get the title right, but it's like Sam Pancake's Monday Afternoon Movie, TV Movie. I should have written that down. But look for Sam Pancake. He's got this great TV movie podcast. He and I got together and we did Birds to Land's End, which is a Showtime original that I actually think is a very good film, despite the fact that it's a quote-unquote Alan Smithy movie. And the people who've reviewed it have been really kind to it, which makes me happy. I did liner notes for Arrow's release of Flatliners, which was a lot of fun for me. I wrote about the history of near-death experiences. I did a commentary for Arrow for a TV movie that's I don't think I've ever covered on the show, but it's called The Initiation of Sarah. It's huge. It's a real famous TV movie. And I was honored to be asked to contribute to it. And I had a lot of fun with that one. And I did a commentary for a movie that hasn't come out yet. I think it's coming out in October through Imprint Films in Australia called Testament, which is originally a made-for-TV movie about a nuclear holocaust, but was released theatrically first, so that Jane Alexander could get nominated for an Oscar, which she did. And it's a really amazing film. And I ended up watching a lot of nuclear war movies, and I got totally depressed for like 6 weeks while I did the commentary. But Testament's, of all the films I've seen, Testament is the best film to me in terms of what it's doing, dealing with an intimate look at a nuclear holocaust. And I think I have another podcast coming. I won't say too much about it now. I'm working on it, and I'm excited, and it's totally different than what I'm doing now. And I will let everybody know when that gets announced. Dan, what are you up to?
Hey, everybody. What's going on? What am I doing? I've forgotten now what I didn't write it down. I am Adventure Super Train is continuing. I think episode 134 or 124, 134. I forget now, just went up, and we are talking, let's see. It's, what are we talking about right in this episode? It's Kiki Wright's and myself. We're talking Tales of the Gold Monkey. We're about halfway through it. That was an action adventure show from the early '80s.
I loved it.
And we're Christopher Bly and myself. We're talking Battlestar Galactica. We just did, what episode was it? We're near the end of the show. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of the episode, but we're almost near the end of Battlestar Galactica. And then Chris and Hawes and myself are discussing The Middleman, which is an incredibly entertaining show from 2008. And then my Happy Days podcast, I just posted about a week ago, episode season 6, episode 4, wow, discussing Sweet 16 and Fearless Melf. And I'll be honest, I'm not really getting that much of a kick out of season 6, but we're approaching season 6 is the one where they did a Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas episode. So I'm excited about those. And they do what an episode called The Claw Meets the Fonz.
Oh, or something like, yeah, that,
which is a classic. So I'm excited about those. And then my Minute by Minute podcasts are still cooking along, although they are about to expand. They haven't quite yet, to 5 minutes at a time rather than 1 minute at a time. And it's A Spooky Minute Spent in a Ghost House, talking about ghost house and spookies. 70s Friends of Frankenstein, talking about Blackenstein and Frankenstein 80. And another one, Howling 2 and 7-2, which is Howling 2, Your Sister's a Werewolf, and Howling 2, Moon Rising. And those are those. And obviously, yeah, at the end of last year, my fourth book, the Henningverse book, which I'm forgetting the name of, but I'm sure is great. Where is it? It's right here. Wait a minute. Shh. From Beverly Hills to Hooterville, Exploring the Henningverse, 1962 to 1971. You can get that on Amazon. And I'm working on my fifth book right now. Well, I've written other books, but my fifth book to be published, which won't be out till next year, but it's Doctor Who related for any of you who are Doctor Who fans. And that's about it, right? We had the Tarantulas commentary came out.
Correct.
And there may be another one coming out. I don't know. I can't say.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully that will be announced soon. So I'll tell you where to follow us online so you can see that when it does get announced. Because Dan and I did another commentary. And I think it's going to be announced by the time this podcast comes out. But I'm not sure. So just you can follow us at TV Mayhem Podcast on Twitter. On Instagram, we're just at Made for TV Mayhem. And on Facebook, just look up the Made for TV Mayhem show. And I'll make a point to post that there. I sometimes forget to post things on the podcast pages, but those are relevant. And you can email us at tvmayhempodcast@gmail.com. Yes. We're going to make such an effort to be more regular. My schedule, and I think Dan's schedule, and I know Nate's schedule, we just went haywire.
It's goofball.
And so things are starting to calm down, and I'm getting excited about doing things that I really enjoy doing commentaries and stuff, but I really like podcasting. It's more fun and laid back and less stressful.
Commentaries are, it's literally like you hit play and go. And if you hope nothing goes wrong for 70, 80, 90 minutes, and it's pretty stressful. Yeah.
Or you're really good at editing and I'm not. So yes, exactly. I just try to do them in one go. But, and also I have half a Trapcast written. So what happened was between the last time we recorded and this day today, Charles Siebert, who played Dr. Riverside, passed away. And I was in the middle of writing my first Charles Siebert-centric script because he's in an episode where it's the first Dr. Riverside episode. And I feel like I want to do a tribute. And so I kind of set it aside and I haven't really figured out what I'm going to do yet. So that really bums me out because I always kind of hoped to maybe I'd get in touch with him somehow, and I even looked him up, and I just wasn't sure really where to contact him. And I was going to see if maybe he'd be willing to let me interview him, and that's obviously not going to happen. But I would like to carry on with the Trapcast, and I feel bad that I have this, which should be somewhat simple thing that I'm trying to do, and I just can't get to it. It kills me. But anyway, so the goal here is for us to keep coming back. I haven't picked the next two episodes or next two movies we're going to cover. But I have asked some people to return that we've had as guests.
Oh, wow.
And maybe invite a couple of new people. So hopefully we'll have some people here that will help egg us on as we go through these next few episodes that will hopefully be coming up before the end of the year. If not, just hang with us. I really appreciate everybody coming back, even though we take these long hiatuses. And you know, I'm hoping that I can make it up with some really good contest swag in the next couple of months. So anyway, that's us for tonight. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Go watch all the Curtis Harrington movies you can watch in one evening. They're all wonderful. And have a good day or evening.
Yeah, be good to yourselves, everyone. Thank you for listening.